this episode, Justice League America number 51 and Justice League Europe number 27, cover dated June 1991. Hello, and welcome to the 51st episode of Justice League International Bwahaha Podcast, a proud member of the Fire & Water Podcast Network. My name's the Irredeemable Shag, and I am your host, but I am not flying solo, folks. Every single episode, we feature two different guest hosts. We'll chat with my second co-host a little bit later, but for now, my first co-host today is a published comic book artist. Now, most recently, as a freelance artist, he's been a bit fed up with clients and his work-for-hire contracts, and now he's working on a comic for his own enjoyment. On top of that, and this is amazing, his girlfriend sounds like the absolute coolest. So he reads his favorite superhero comics to Wendy, doing voices for the characters, and apparently she adores this. This is amazing, you lucky guy. Folks, please help me welcome to the show Mr. Jonathan Riddle. Welcome to the New York Embassy, Jonathan. Thanks for being here, man. How you doing?
Yes, shagadoo. I'm here for the surprise party.
I'm sorry, Nort. There is no surprise party. No one is hiding. No one is going to jump out.
You mean you don't have everybody up in the closet? What do you mean there's no surprise party?
Folks, if you haven't read the issue, you don't have probably have no idea where this Ed Norton bit is coming from. But that is a really good Ed Norton for impersonation, first of all, and that is almost directly line for line what Nort does in the issue. That's awesome. So are these an example of some of the voices you do with Wendy?
Sure. So Nort obviously is one of them. Her absolute favorite is Etrigan the Demon. So for that one, I do this like Cockney accent. So the thing is, I introduced to her two versions of Etrigan, one from Alan Moore's run of Swamp Thing and one from the Dan Mishkin, Gary Cohn Blue Devil comics.
Woohoo!
How Etrigan appears in both of them simultaneously, but has a very different feel. So in Blue Devil Annual number one, the Summer Fun Annual, Etrigan appears as one of the major characters, and he talks almost exclusively in limericks.
I can't tell you how much I love that Blue Devil Annual and Up. It is one of the single greatest comics of all time.
It really is.
So, all right, how did all this start? How did Wendy, because I've been married now for 18 years, and if I were to read a comic book in voices to my wife, she'd probably check me into like a psychiatric ward or something. So how did this start with you reading comics to Wendy and finding out that she was going to, respond positively to this?
Well, the very first comic that we read together was Saga of the Swamp Thing number 21.
Oh, my
classic
gosh.
Issue. Oh, yeah. So I figure that this is my make or break issue. If she likes this, then it's smooth sailing from there.
Alan Moore purple prose, baby.
Oh, yeah. And the fun thing about it is I think the reason why this has become a thing that we do regularly is just because I'm so passionate about comic books.
Okay.
So when we go through the issue, if there's something I notice in the artwork, like a transition from panel to panel or panel to page, or a specific trick that the artist is doing to lead the eye through the issue, I'll point it out. Or if there's a fun little background detail in there, or what they're doing with that Alan Moore purple prose, for example, then I can point that out. And so she's been learning sort of the language of reading a comic book without having to consult with Scott McCloud about it.
Now, this is great because you're using your expertise as a comic book artist to interpret what's going on the page. See, like, I don't have that kind of skill set. I'm just like, oh, these pictures look pretty. Whereas you can actually look at it and see what they're doing from a storytelling perspective. So that's amazing. It's got to work in your favor.
I'd like to think so. And also, it helps my appreciation of it even more when I can see a little bit of the wires that are holding up the puppets, so to speak.
So you've drawn one comic professionally and you're doing another one for yourself right now. Is that right?
That's right. The piece that I completed for a client, it's over 300 pages. Took me a couple of years to do because it's a historical and it's a biographical comic about World War II and about the Czech Republic.
Mm.
So a lot of research went into it. It's based off a survivor of the Ravensbrück concentration camp in Germany. Wow. And apparently this survivor used to give tours and interviews where she would talk about her experiences during the war and the incarceration and her survival. So my client was the writer, and he interviewed her and collected notes, and he's a big fan of comics, and he thought it would be a good story for a graphic novel. I happen along, fresh-faced out of college, looking for a piece to work and a chance to prove myself, and happened in at the right place at the right time, got the contract, drew the book. Like I said, it took a couple years to finish. The book is titled With Only Five Plums. We broke it down into three volumes because the page count was so immense. It was cheaper to print it in smaller chunks than as one massive telephone book omnibus.
Right.
And after that, I was working on another project that fell through for reasons. So more recently, I've really been finding my joy in drawing my own pages and doing stories that make me happy and jokes that make me laugh with characters that I'm interested in. And it's been very fulfilling. The piece I'm working on right now is called Superfluous City, and it's about a group of supervillains, very few costumes, no powers, but they all have egos the size of Cleveland, and a large part of the story takes place in a prison that's not so much meant to reform super criminals as it is to refine them into being better super criminals, because villain hero conflicts help generate the economy.
Oh my gosh, that's hilarious. That sounds fantastic.
I'm having a lot of fun working on it.
Well, I always say it's about finding your joy, and it certainly sounds like that's what you're doing there. That's awesome.
Thank you.
Well, I gotta say, Jonathan, I'm really excited to have you here to talk about this issue, because Adam Hughes is drawing it. You've got a lot of insight as to beyond. I'm just like, pretty pictures. You're going to give us a lot of insight as to what's going on and how he built this page, as you say, constructed it. And that's awesome. Now, folks, for you at home, this issue, is you're going to have to buy it digitally or behind the floppy, because it's we are now officially beyond the JLI omnibuses. You know, there's been two omnibuses that are out. Well, it stopped JLA number 50. And here we are at 51. So you can find it on DC Infinite. You can buy it on Comixology. You can go get it, a floppy copy out of the bins. But definitely get your hands on this, because it's absolutely worth looking at. All right. Well, you know what? Before we get too much further, though, we do need to take a second to thank our sponsor. Folks, this episode of the JLI podcast is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStock Trades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. Now, each episode, we select a collected edition to briefly discuss from the InStock Trades library. Usually, it's tied into that issue in some way, shape, or fashion. I picked Green Lantern Corps Hardcover, Volume 1, Beware Their Power. Now, this reprints the old Green Lantern Corps series, from the 80s. So, it's issues 207 through 215, and Tales of the Green Lantern Corps Annual Number 2. So, yeah, this is the Steve Englehart, Joe Staton run, a little dash of Alan Moore in there as well. And the reason I picked it, because these are the early issues that focus on Kilowog when he goes over to the Soviet Union and helps create the Rocky Reds. Well, for me, these were my first Green Lantern Corps issues I ever bought, my first exposure to Kilowog. So it's very exciting for me, and it ties in nicely with this issue because we've got Kilowog. So this collection is 264 pages. It is a hardcover, full color. Normally goes for $39.99, but you can get it for 42% off right now, so it's only $23.19. Now, Jonathan, I got to ask, you seem like a pretty cool guy who may have done his homework, so did you happen to bring an InStock Trades recommendation?
Yes, indeed. So I am reading that Green Lantern volume right now and having a blast going through that.
Awesome.
My InStock Trades recommendation is Saga of the Swamp Thing, Volume 2 by Alan Moore, Stephen Bissett, John Totleben, and Sean McManus. Little left field, but I figure going with the theme of aliens in the DC universe, this is a magnificent old chestnut that really deserves being dusted off.
Okay.
Admirers of Neil Gaiman's Sandman should take special note, as not only did Gaiman pen the special introduction in the book, but the inclusion of Cain and Abel, as well as Matthew Cable, were a big influence on the Sandman comics to follow this volume.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's 224 pages, full-color softcore, retails for $19.99. At 42% off, the in-stock trades price comes to $11.59. And what you get with that is a loving and tragic Pogo homage with adorable alien creatures.
Mm-hmm.
The issue that broke the Comics Code Authority, a psychedelic love song, a round trip ticket through both heaven and hell, the original House of Secrets origin of Swamp Thing, appearances by Cain and Abel, Dead Man, the Phantom Stranger, Etrigan the Demon, and the Spectre, and all of that for $11.09. You can't beat it.
That is fantastic. What a steal. $11.59. That is like, that's like giving it away. That is amazing. And think about all those characters you just mentioned. Almost all of them have been on the big screen, either whether television or movies in recent years, which is crazy to think of.
I can't imagine how exciting it would be for Wendy in particular to see Etrigan appear on the big screen.
It's just a matter of time. It's just a matter of time. So folks, for this and all your other trade paperback needs, please visit instocktrades.com. Now, this episode is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support. Because, you know, running the Fire and Water Podcast Network with so many shows, you know, it requires a lot of like hosting and service fees and things like that. And a while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses. So we launched the Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying the JLI podcast, the best way to support the show is by visiting our Patreon, which is patreon.com/FW podcast. When you're there, please consider supporting the Fire and Water Podcast Network. And in certain tiers, you'll get mentioned on your show of choice, just like these folks who asked to be recognized on the JLI podcast. Our thanks to Christopher Lewis, David Ace Gutierrez, DC Dave, Devin Clancy, George Van Note, Gord Tolton, John Coos, John Ross Haynes, Kevin Wetter, Mark Baker Wright, Martin Gray, Matt Ev, Maxwell Traver, Michael Crouch, Mike Zumkowski, Roger Preeb, Rudy Castillo, Sean Ross, Superman Radio Revisited Podcast, and Tim Price. Again, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW podcast. All right, so I say this all the time, folks, and I mean it. I need you to be part of this show. Your comments, your thoughts are such a big part of the show. We talk about it in the feedback every episode. I want you to go out to our website, which is firewaterpodcast.com/JLI. Leave your comments on the show post. Go out on the social medias. Use the hashtag FW Podcast or tag us, JLI Podcast, on Twitter and on Facebook. Because as I always say, it's about building an online community of JLI fans around the show. I mean, that's how you ended up here, Jonathan, is you left some comments on the show. And we ended up chatting that way, and you ended up here. So now I got to ask you, what is your personal origin story with the JLI? How'd you find the book? How'd you fall in love with it? You know, what do you think, man?
So, like a lot of your former guests and many of your listeners, I have a confession to make. I had a Batman phase.
Everyone has a Batman phase.
Well, like most of my generation, that particular phase reached its zenith in the summer of 1989.
Really? Did something happen that summer?
You know, it was so long ago. If you can remember it, you really weren't there, man.
Hang on. Let me finish eating this bowl of Batman cereal. Then I'll get back to you.
Yeah. All right. So I grew up out in the sticks. And that means that finding comics was a difficult thing. I didn't have regular access to a comic book store or even a bookstore in a lot of cases. So I learned to find comics in unorthodox places. So some of my favorites at the time were like pharmacies, cigar stores, hobby shops, and flea markets. I remember specifically when I was a little kid, my grandma would take me to the cigar store that, yes, had a wooden Indian in the corner.
Awesome.
The whole place would smell of floor polish and cherry tobacco. It's great. So my grandma would take me there, and she used to spoil me rotten when I was little. They had a spinner rack in one corner of the store, and I was allowed to pick out any one thing, which when I was very little was always Superman until I hit my Batman phase. Now, looking for comics in weird places, I hit an absolute buried treasure in the spring of 1994 in the back section of the Ben Franklin's craft store.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you had one of those?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Gosh, I don't feel old at all.
Come on, Grandma. It's time to get you to bed.
So back behind the rows of fabric bolts and yarn balls, I found a copy of Mayfair Games, the Batman role-playing game, clearanced and price marked at $1.
That is amazing.
So I bought that and pored over that book. Thing was, though, it had a lot of stuff that I'd never heard of. Yeah, so who's the Calendar Man? Or Nemesis, or fan favorite, The Outsiders.
Right.
But I had help. it's around this exact same time, 94 or so, that I discovered there's this index of comics that explain every character and location in the whole DC universe. You could say it's a veritable who's who of listings.
I've never heard of such a thing.
You know, it was such a handy guide that honestly, somebody really ought to record a podcast about that.
Why would anyone waste their time doing that?
Why would anyone waste their time listening to that?
Ouch!
I'll hold up my own hand. Guilty as charged. Who's Who is one of my absolute favorites, man. You and Rob knock it out of the park. It's so much fun to listen to.
Oh, you're too kind. I quite honestly, I can't vouch for the quality of the show, but if no one else was going to do it, I had to do it just so I could listen to it. Because, you know, I love the book that much.
It's a contribution to the community.
There we go.
So one of the issues that I had early on was issue number 5, which contained Clayface, Croc, and Copperhead, which were all mentioned in the role-playing book. Mm-hmm. You know who else was in that book was the Clock King and Clue Master on back-to-back pages.
Nice.
Right. So Clue Master, that's a Batman villain. I must know more. Mm-hmm. So later on, a couple years after that, I recognize Messrs. Clock King and Clue Master on the cover of a copy of JLI number 23 sitting on a magazine rack in an antique store.
Ah, okay.
Which means I was finally going to get to see what the Clock King and Clue Master were made of. And boy, howdy, did I ever.
Not what you're expecting, I bet.
No, but what I ended up getting was the genius that is Kevin Maguire with those great facial expressions, especially on Guy Gardner and Mr. Miracle. Mm-hmm. And even though Batman doesn't even show up in the issue that Clue Master shows up in, I didn't get a Clue Master Batman slugfest of the ages, but I got a really great comic book. Mm-hmm. And I've been a JLI fan ever since reading that.
Oh, that's awesome. Okay. So did you, at that point, because, you know, 94 or later, they're, you know, Giffen and DeMatteis are off the book. Did you find back issues? Did you only read them sporadically? What happened there?
There was this fantastic little comic shop in Marion, Ohio. It's no longer there, unfortunately, called Brad's Bookstore Comic Odyssey. And the place was stacked floor to ceiling with these dusty old paperbacks of like romance novels, crime pulp thrillers, sci-fi books from the 60s. And in one section of the shop, he had quarter bins of back issue comics.
Nice.
That place was my mecca. Anytime I got to go to Brad's, I would buy these stacks of back issues for a quarter apiece. So through the stuff at Brad's bookstore, I discovered the George Perez Marv Wolfman Teen Titans. I discovered Suicide Squad and Grimjack by John Ostrander. Just some amazing books. And it really shaped what I like and what I read today.
It's so funny because, yeah, back then you could go through the quarter bins, or in my case, they were 50 cent bins, and you could get almost complete runs of stuff nowadays, which is revered. You know, it sells for top dollar. But back then, the bins were just stupid with it. You know, I put together like almost a complete collection of Teen Titans from those bins. I put together a complete collection almost of Guy Alpha Flight from those bins. I mean, just tons. Well, okay, maybe they're not top tier. I like them. Either way, but a lot of different books, Suicide Squad as well. That's where you pick up that kind of stuff. That's time. Have really changed.
So a lot of that are books that I've introduced to Wendy as well, like in particular Suicide Squad. One of her other favorite characters that I read is Deadshot, which basically I read like he's Charles Bronson.
That's perfect. That's about right. Yeah.
Yep. I think the big difference between collecting those quarter bins, 50 cent bin issues and getting complete runs of stuff that's revered today is back then that stuff wasn't on television and on the big screen.
That's fair. That's fair. That definitely makes a big change, doesn't it?
It does indeed. And you realize, Shag, that you and I are living in a geek's paradise. We're overwhelmed with choices. There's so much cool stuff out there.
That's the crazy thing is that, you know, go back in time 20 years ago and we were desperate for anything. You know, we would even welcome Steal the Movie because we were so desperate for anything, right? You know, Batman and Robin, that terrible film, or the Birds of Prey TV show, any of these things that, you know, maybe didn't hold up.
I got one for you.
What you got?
Do you remember special event programming on Fox TV, David Hasselhoff and Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
Believe it or not, I actually skipped that one on purpose because it was Hasselhoff. But you know, if it makes you feel better, I made sure to catch Generation X because I wasn't going to miss that. I can't remember her name now, but that Fiona, maybe the actress who was on General Hospital, she was playing Emma Frost. I was not going to miss that one.
I took time out of my week to make sure I watched both of those when they aired on television.
So you look at that when we were hungry for anything, and we look now, and I can, you know, as awful as this is, I can turn up my nose and go, you know, I'm not watching The Flash anymore. I'm not enjoying it. Or, oh gosh, I haven't got to the theater yet to watch Black Adam. I mean, there's so much of the content out there now. We can pick and choose and just skip stuff entirely, which is crazy. I feel like a bad geek.
I know how you feel. I mean, I can't keep up with what's all out there. And yes, it's got to a point where I can pick and choose and decide I'm not interested in this. I'm going to wait for that. And what the heck is this thing?
Right. I know. Like, I keep telling myself, there's a movie in the theaters right now featuring the JSA, the freaking JSA, who, okay, you guys know I love the JLI. You know I do. But the JSA is like my favorite superhero team of all time. And I haven't been to the theater to see it yet. That's just messed up. Ugh.
And it features Pierce Brosnan as Dr. Fate.
I know. James Bond is Dr. Fate. That's insane. Better yet, Remington Steele is Dr. Fate.
There you go.
Well, tell you what, we probably should get into this issue, or we're going to sit here and sound like two old men on telling all the kids to get off their lawns because we liked things when we were younger. But anyway.
Takes one to know one.
Right. Folks, we are going to get into this. And if you want to see some of the pages, not all of them, just some of the pages, go out to our website, which is firewaterpodcast.com/JLI, and you will see some of the pages from this issue. But seriously, go out and buy it digitally on Comixology. Check it on DC Infinite. Go get the hard copy. It's a great comic. You should have it in your hands.
It's a great comic.
It really is. All right, folks, we are talking about Justice League America number 51, published by DC Comics. Cover date is June 1991. On the shelves, April 9th, 1991. Cover price is $1 for shiny quarters. Covers by Adam Hughes and Joe Rubenstein. So, Jonathan, do you want to describe the cover for us?
I really do. So we see a point of view from inside a New York taxicab, where the sky visible outside through the back window indicates it's a dark and stormy night. Crammed uncomfortably in the back seat of the cab, we have Kilowog, Nort, and the Martian Manhunter looking for a ride. The cab driver in the foreground lets the meter run as he looks behind him and, without dropping the cigar that's still burning in his mouth, says, "You guys got a problem back there or what?"
This cover is amazing. It is hilarious. I gotta say, you described it, but folks, you can tell it's a New York City taxi cab, but there's so little to show you that it's there. And yet you can tell immediately because Adam Hughes is a master. I mean, all you're seeing is a window, three guys sitting there, and the guy in the front, and maybe a little bit of a steering wheel. And yet you know immediately what you're looking at. That's how amazing Adam Hughes is.
You can tell the meter's running because of the position of the flag in the bottom left corner of the page.
That's true. Good point. Good point.
And there's a little bit of a rear view mirror visible just below the DC logo.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So I absolutely love that. You know, and it's really effective use of the setup too, the composition, because like he's used the ceiling of the cab to be the black background behind the logo. So it's wasted space. Don't even worry about it. It's the ceiling of the car. The driver in the foreground, I mean, he's got that just look of, I don't know, not disgust, but just like, ugh, you know, towards his customers. The trio in the back behind the plexiglass are hilarious. They're so squished together. And he's got the eye break for aliens button on his hat, which is fantastic.
You notice he's got some beard stubble. The cigar is partially burned down and his hair's all disheveled. So it looks like he's been in that cab for a while.
Yeah, he probably smells really good.
Like all New York taxi riders, right?
Right, exactly. So here's something really cool. If you look on the taxi driver's shirt, he's got a couple buttons on there. One of the buttons is Adam Hughes and Joe Rubenstein's signature, which is fairly clever. But he also has another button, which is a little face. And one of our listeners, who goes by Enemy of the Shoe on Twitter, his name is Brian Siufu. I know that's wrong. I'm so sorry, Brian. Anyway, Brian asked, what's that button supposed to represent? So I reached out to Adam Hughes on Twitter and said, hey, just curious whose face this is on the button. Adam Hughes was kind enough to respond almost right away. And he pointed out, he said, that is Flip the Clown from Winsor McKay's Little Nemo in Slumberland, which at the time when he drew this, he had just discovered that, which is what a cool thing to throw in there.
That is so cool.
I just think that's cool that he slipped in something he was passionate about. It's all, again, because it's all about finding your joy.
And there's little bits of that all throughout this comic.
Yeah.
One of the things I've noticed, to order to guide a reader through the images, in the Western world, everybody reads from left to right. And you'll notice that this cover does the exact same thing where you start with our three main characters, our recognizable Justice League characters. So we got Kilowog, Nort, and Martian Manhunter, and they're all on the left side and they're all looking right. So it leads you right along to the cab driver and they're all on the same eye line. So it's just natural for you to sweep across that line to see all of the characters in the order that Hughes means for you to see them.
That is interesting. I didn't even see. That's why comic artists can pick up these things. Now, I always have heard that people read things like covers in a Z fashion. They go top left, top right, they slide down, bottom left, bottom right, which would work in this case too, because it just exactly described the three aliens to the cab driver, then down to where you see the meter and the wheel, which is what's the tell to you. You go, oh, okay, this is definitely a cab. You know, you get those things. Mm-hmm. So it works in that way too.
You can also do a Z from DC logo across the title banner, credits, and then zip down Kilowog's face and across, and that's a Z formation as well.
Yeah, it is. Good point. Unless you have anything more on the cover, let's get inside.
Let's get inside.
All right, so plot, and these are written into the comic, guys. I did not make up these terms. So plot is by Svelte Keith Giffen. Script is by Slim J.M. DeMatteis. Penciler is Tall Adam Hughes. Inker is Big Joe Rubenstein. Letter is Elliptical Bob LePan. Colorist is Square Gene D'Angelo. Assistant editor is Amorphous Kevin Tooley. Editor is Hexagonal Andy Helfer. And the title of the issue is My Dinner with Nort. You want to start us off?
Absolutely. So our story begins with an ominous green jumpsuited figure lowering from the skies over New York. Is it the Red Skull? The Mad Thinker? Dr. Octopus? None of those. Just when you thought it was safe to read the Justice League, he's back. Nepotistic Green Lantern, Nort Esplanade Niesmacher, lands on the JLI New York Embassy rooftop looking for the companionship of his fellow superheroes. He gets himself so worked up with fantasies of a warm reception, by the time he gets in, he's convinced himself there's a surprise party waiting for him inside. What he finds instead is Liberty the Wonder Pup, General Glory's trusty bulldog. Nort finds a lot in common with Liberty, even though the idea of multiple dogs in the JLA roster does upset him just a little bit. John Jones comes by, grumpily informing Nort that none of the Leaguers are available to visit with him, with John himself just passing through on his way to engage in some private meditation. Nort settles down with Liberty in the parlor, but before he can imbue the pup with any of his wisdom from being a super dog himself, he's given an unexpected welcome from resident JLA Mr. Fixit and one-time communist curious Green Lantern, Kilowog. Turns out Wog is positively stir-crazy with no one else around and sees Nort's visit as the perfect excuse to get out of the embassy and enjoy the many splendors of the New York nightlife. When Elrond interrupts John's meditation with the news, the Martian races to flag the two down. Nort, ever the team player, offers John the opportunity to join in on the fun, if only to serve as babysitter. The hijinks begin early when the ridiculously muscled Kilowog shreds over a dozen finely tailored suits while trying on evening wear at a men's big and tall outfitter. Our resident ringslinger saves the evening by fashioning a perfectly cut suit with his power ring, but not before the two extraterrestrials manage to run up a hefty bill on Maxwell Lord's credit account. Meanwhile, erstwhile leaguer Booster Gold pops in at the embassy only to find the same sparse reception that Nort received earlier in the issue. But unlike the optimistic Nort, Booster's expecting a humiliating barrage of practical jokes at the hands of his former colleague and BFF Blue Beetle. When Elrond informs Booster that John Kilowog and Nort have gone out for dinner and a show, Booster smugly kicks back in anticipation of the disaster that's sure to shortly commence. And it turns out that Booster's predictions may be spot on, as the first half of the boys' plans go belly up when they get kicked out of a Broadway theater in the middle of the show due to Nort's canine instincts getting the better of him before the play can finish. The production is, of course, none other than Andrew Lloyd Webber's Cats. For the theater players in attendance that fateful night, the only memories will be traumatic ones.
I'll take it from there with a tip of my plagiarism hat to the Idlehead of Diablo blog. Stole a little bit from there, so thank you, Frank. So, back at the embassy, Booster anxiously awaits the eventual call from the police about the alien trio's night on the town. In fact, Booster bets Elrond that Nort will land the aliens in jail. Well, Elrond insists that Martian Manhunter will beat the rap. Once Blue Beetle arrives, the blue and gold make with the hilarity. Now, back out on the night on the town, our heroes, of course, Martian Manhunter, Nort, and Kilowog, they find themselves at a swanky restaurant in the World Trade Center. Yeah, that's weird for me too. Yeah, but let's just enjoy it, folks, for now. So by sheer coincidence, or the joy of sitcoms and comics, dining at the same establishment in civilian clothes is the villain formerly known as the Black Hand. Now, you may recall back in JLA number 28, Black Hand had a nervous breakdown triggered by Guy Gardner and Ice's first date. Well, now Black Hand has been released from the mental hospital, fully recovered from his acute hero phobia, and he's telling his gang that they're going legit. At the restaurant, our heroes arrive for their dinner reservation, but it takes some power ring-induced hijinks for Nort to get past the maitre d'. Once inside, Martian Manhunter caves to peer pressure from Nort and Kilowog, and Jean changes his appearance from a typical human and reverts to his usual alien form. Well, unfortunately, this triggers Black Hand's hero phobia. Martian Manhunter ducks as the plain-clothed Black Hand lunges at the table, sending himself and Nort through the window. Now, keep in mind, they're on one of the top floors of the World Trade Center. As Black Hand and Nort, who, by the way, is missing his power ring, plummet to their doom, Martian Manhunter dives in to rescue the pair, though he notes that Black Hand's mind has shut down from the stress. In their absence, Kilowog brawls with Black Hand's lackeys until the police arrive. Back at the embassy, Elrond's perplexed at how Booster Gold accurately predicted the alien trio would end up in jail. Later, as Nort flies away from the embassy, he describes his version of the arraignment hearing. It talks about Martian Manhunter's anger and the blue and the gold giggling. Meanwhile, Blue Beetle taunts at Martian Manhunter's recent fiasco by posting embarrassing newspaper headlines around the embassy. The final page shows Black Hand nearly catatonic at the home for the terminally bewildered. Next issue, Guy Gardner and Blue Beetle in the fight of the century. Yeah, folks, it's the boxing issue. Then it says, plus, the single most shocking development in the history of the JLI, and we're not kidding. Don't miss it. Ooh, foreboding. All right, well, let's get into this, man. What'd you think of the issue?
Man, this thing can be a masterclass on how to do storytelling in a comic book. We've discussed the story, but we haven't even talked about Adam Hughes's brilliant artwork.
Lay it on me.
All right. So starting with page one, we get this great shot of Nort, and we know that it's the New York skyline because we have the Ma Bell logo on one of the buildings, and we have the iconic Empire State Building off to the left side. And then the angle for Nort with the giant feet, because we're looking at his feet forward, almost like he's standing on the comic that we're reading. And it makes him look both comical and impressive at the exact same time, which is an amazing feat, pun intended, all of a sudden, for Hughes to do. I'm not above a good pun.
I love that you can see the pads of his feet just like a dog. It is so funny. Like, I don't even know how Adam Hughes thought to, you know, or Keith Giffen did the breakdowns, whatever, thought to even create this angle. And how do you capture it so well with the foreshortening and make it work? But it does.
And foreshortening is tough to do well. And this just knocks it out of the park.
Yeah.
Also notice for the logo itself, of course, we have the word Nort in green, representing the Green Lantern, but everything else is in red. So we start with a pattern of red words. And then when Nort's name comes in, it's at an italicized angle and the color switches, which tells your brain subconsciously that Nort is always breaking the established pattern.
Ah, well, it also breaks the pattern of that famous phrase, because it's the name, I would assume, is a play on the famous story, My Dinner with Andre. So here you get, instead of My Dinner with Andre, you get My Dinner with Nort. So it's breaking, you're right, sort of breaking that.
And we get a second pop culture reference in Just When You Thought It Was Safe to Read the Justice League, which is a play on the movie poster for Jaws 2, Just When You Thought It Was Safe to Go Back in the Water.
Exactly, exactly.
Now, I'm going to skip ahead some straight to page 5, because I love this page. Now, there's a rule that I was taught in college called the 360-degree rule. And the idea is that when you establish a setting and the characters positioned within that setting, that if your next image flips that setting by 360 degrees, you run a very real risk of disorienting your viewer. And here in panels 1 and 2, we have a shot of Kilowog entering what looks like a parlor or a living room with Nort sitting at a chair. And then panel 2, we have what looks like an almost 360-degree flip of the room layout. And there's certain little tricks that Hughes is doing in these two panels to keep you from getting jostled from one image to the next. So there's a doily draped over the chair where Nort is sitting to make that look distinctive.
Mm-hmm.
And Kilowog is wearing a sports jersey with the number 82 on it. So not only is Kilowog already a very distinctive looking character, but you can see that 82 on his back in panel 1, and it appears again on his chest in panel 2. So your brain follows that continuity from image to image without getting confused. It's really well done.
It really is. It really is.
And then in panel 3, we have cropping of the characters that you should never, ever do in a comic book. If you look at the image, Kilowog's head is almost completely cropped off at the top of the panel border. And Nort's bottom half of his head is completely cropped off by the bottom border of the panel. And this is obviously a no-no because it cuts off the visage of your character, so the reader can't tell who's saying what or who's in the panel. But Hughes is doing this for a deliberate effect to show how much larger Kilowog is than Nort.
I didn't even notice that their heads were cut off. I knew who was in the scene, and I never thought twice about it. But you're right. Oh, that's brilliant.
Oh, yeah. The thing is, when you understand the rules, you can break the rules with deliberation and forethought and get great effects. And Hughes just does this time and again throughout this comic. This is one I really enjoy.
That's amazing. Wow. I never would have picked up on that.
We get to panel 4, and the characters who are talking aren't even in the panel. Instead, what we get is a shot of Fire, who looks smoking hot as only Adam Hughes could depict.
Yes, she does.
And you can tell based on the fact that she's clearly heading to the right side of the panel, and she's putting a shoe on one foot, and she's got a hat and a belt and like very deliberately coiffed and dressed up, that she's heading out for a night of town on her own. So while our main characters are going to have their night out on the town, Fire is doing something completely separate from that that you'll never get to see, but you see her leave. And later in the comic, you see her after she returns. So you get the suggestion that there's more to this story that you can just imagine. Absolutely love it.
She looks amazing. And of course, you know, it's Adam Hughes drawing Fire, which is exactly what we all want to see. So he made sure to fit that panel in here somewhere, I'm sure.
Yep. And you notice the perspective of the wall starts short and ends higher. So like the slant leads your eye from left to right using the perspective of the room so that you follow straight into the Elrond image in the foreground of the last panel, which also goes straight to Kilowog and Nort because you're going from left to right.
That's amazing. I all these things I never in a million years would have picked up on.
So moving on to page 7, we get Kilowog saying an off-color comment about,
so we hit a few dozen bars, hear some music, hit on some babes. Isn't that right? Guy told me that's what all Earth guys do.
And listeners note, you should not take your dating etiquette from Guy Gardner, but I honestly think that Kilowog would make a superb wingman.
Oh, yeah, totally. Absolutely. At least this version of Kilowog. Maybe not the drill sergeant version, but this version of Kilowog would be an awesome wingman.
Well, at this point, he's not a member of the Green Lantern Corps, right?
He was, and now he's currently not. Which, you know, I did think about the fact that there's Nort sitting there with a Green Lantern ring, almost flaunting in front of Kilowog's face. It made Kilowog kind of be like, can I just take a spin with that or something? I mean, he's got to miss it, right? Anyway, yes, he's not currently a member of the Green Lantern Corps.
Nah, Kilowog is so chill and zen. He's happy for Nort, and he's just happy to spend some time with a fellow elf.
That's true.
We'll get to the elf comments in a moment. So I'm going to move on to page 8. And panel 1 here, we see a Zoftig figure walking out of a men's big and tall outfitter. And personally, I want to believe that's our Alfred Hitchcock cameo.
Oh, it's actually not. I'll tell you where the Alfred Hitchcock cameo comes in a little bit.
There's an Alfred Hitchcock cameo I didn't notice.
Well, there's not an Alfred Hitchcock, but Alfred Hitchcock always put himself in his own work. Well, the creator, Adam Hughes, did put himself in this issue, and I'll tell you where it is later.
Oh, stay tuned for that. And you'll notice that the not Alfred Hitchcock walking out of the store has an outline because there's a building that's silhouetted all in black that's completely surrounding him. So it makes that figure pop out so that your eye goes straight to him because of the contrast.
Mm-hmm.
Now, going on to page 9. And I absolutely love page 9 because it features my absolute favorite JLI member of all time, Booster Gold.
Woohoo!
And you notice something that Hughes does here is the first panel, we don't even see Booster. And then the panels to follow, 2, 3, and 4, as a horizontal strip, you don't get a clear shot of his face.
Right.
He's either too far away, he's got his back turned, he's got his head turned to the side, or he's cropped off where you can't see his face at all. So it's like you're being slowly introduced to Booster image by image. And that means when you get to the final panel, panel 6, and you get a shot of Booster's face and just the sheer smug expression, it hits home even harder because it's the first time you get a clear shot of his face on the entire page.
Well, it's also a gorgeously rendered shot. I mean, he is mugging for the camera. He's looking directly at the reader, and it's expertly illustrated. I love the lighting going on. He's done all dark blues, but the lighting of the windows is kind of shining, or maybe it's the monitor shining on his face. And then there's like, because he's wearing the goggles, he's done like some pointillism around the eyes. It is a great looking shot of Booster.
So how blessed are we as JLI fans that we get both Kevin Maguire and Adam Hughes doing these amazing facial expressions through a long run of the book. Makes me glad to be alive, doesn't it?
It's an embarrassment of riches. You get Bart Sears over on Justice League Europe. You know, we've had Ty Templeton as well. We've got other fantastic artists that have been on this book. I mean, it's ridiculous the amount of talent that's been on these books. It's crazy.
Mr. Templeton, Mr. Sears, if you are listening, my sincerest apologies. I love the artwork on JLA when it was Templeton and JLE when it was Sears. Amazing stuff. I feel spoiled.
And folks, just as a plug for myself, if you haven't bothered to listen yet, go back to last month, the November episode, and you can hear an interview with Bart Sears. In fact, you can even watch it on YouTube, where I interviewed Bart Sears all about his time on Justice League Europe.
That is so cool. All right, next up, I'm going to page 14. And I want to point out that you can tell Keith Giffen is at least aiding, if not doing the major lifting on the page layout, because we have the infamous Keith Giffen 9-panel grid.
We sure do. I want to point something out here, and this has been throughout the issue, but I'll just chime in here. I love the way that Adam Hughes has chosen to represent Nort, because almost every issue or every artist draws Nort a different way. Like, I mean, from his very first appearance by Kevin Maguire to every appearance since then, everybody seems to put their own touch on him. And this version of Nort, well, it's not, quote unquote, my version of Nort that I always think of. I still love it. He's super skinny. He's very, very skinny. His head is long and thin. He's got a very long, pointed human nose. He's got the big floppy ears that stick up on the top. He's just adorable. It also, he tends, because of the vest and everything, and his gait and his walk and his build, he definitely echoes Ed Norton, which you were doing the voice of earlier, obviously. I just think Adam Hughes draws a really great Nort.
Indeed. And you can get so much expression out of the position of his ears.
Yes. And his little, and the way he does his eyebrows, because he just gives them little black circles for the eyes. But he does so much with the eyeballs and the eyebrows as well.
Absolutely. I trust you're familiar with the live action show, The Tick, starring Patrick Warburton.
Absolutely.
So there was a puppeteer that was manipulating his antennae on top of his head.
Okay.
And I remember one of the bonus features on the DVD talks about how Warburton was always self-conscious of those antennae because being directly on top of his head, he couldn't see their position or where they were moving.
Okay.
And he was always self-conscious as to whether or not the antennae and the puppeteer manipulating him were getting more laughs than he was.
Aww.
Consummate professional. And the next time you watch the show, because everybody needs an excuse to watch that show again, notice the antennae and how they move based on what Warburton is saying or what's happening to the tick in the scene. They're always reflecting his mood.
Right. Oh, that's, I hadn't thought about that show in a while. Oh, that'd be fun to revisit.
Absolutely. And I'm going to go ahead to page 15. I love the fact that while Booster's sitting around bored, he turns to gambling as a form of entertainment. Like, that is so Booster.
Yes. And it's, you know, seeing Booster and Beetle together here too, by the way. They start cracking wise with each other. They're being snarky. It's just like when a couple of guys get together. It feels like, honest to goodness, two best friends riffing on each other. And given that we haven't seen them together in a long time, because Booster's been over in the conglomerate, you kind of forget how much fun they are together when you read this month to month, rather than like binging the whole series at once. And it's really great to see them together again.
And in panel 4, we get Beetle saying, how you doing, buddy? And reading that, I hear your voice, Shag, in that dialogue balloon.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I'll take that as a compliment, I guess.
I think you'd make a great Blue Beetle if they were looking for voice actors.
Maybe in the next issue more so.
Stay tuned, listeners.
Right.
Now, on page 16, we have another absolutely brilliant page. So once again, we start with the aspect of the setting without actually showing the characters yet. We know we're in a restaurant because we see a waitress holding aloft a tray above the shoulder. That's a stereotypical waiter-waitress pose. And we've got the dialogue balloons over on the right side, leading off stage right. So we know who's talking because we were at this scene earlier in the issue. And coming back to it, this is a really nice reception to back at the restaurant.
Yeah.
In the middle strip here.
Okay, before you even do that, all right?
Yeah.
I got to mention, first of all, the waitress looks totally super 80s Marky Post hot, right? But look in that top panel to the far right. I didn't even notice this now, but now you've got me looking at every nook and cranny. On the right-hand side, the maitre d' is chewing out a waitress because she's chewing bubblegum. Like, I didn't even notice it till now, and I didn't even know what it meant till I stopped to think about it. Why is there a girl blowing a bubble, and why is there a guy talking to her? That is, but you can see he's got a bow tie. He is clearly the maitre d', and she's clearly a server, and she's in trouble for chewing bubblegum.
Yes, because she's wearing the same vest as our foreground server.
Exactly, exactly.
And he has a towel draped over his left arm.
Yep.
The way that you would see a maitre d' do.
Exactly right. Wow, look at the attention to detail. He just embeds in the background. That's amazing.
Oh, that's so rich. There's so many things to just enjoy here. So coming to the middle strip, Adam Hughes once again takes one of the conventional rules of storytelling, completely breaks it. But because he's aware that the rule exists, he gets away with it. So this next rule is something called left panel stacking. And the idea is that if you stack a bunch of smaller panels on the left side of your page, and then you have a corresponding larger panel that takes up the right half, you can run into an error where the person will read the first of the smaller panels and then cut across because they're reading in a Z formation, and they'll get to the wrong panel because they don't know they're supposed to read down rather than to the right. So there's a couple tricks here that Hughes is doing to make sure that you don't run into that problem. The first off is we have this great image of Nort sitting at the chair, and he's got one leg cocked up behind his head in an impossible stretch where he's scratching his ear with his lower foot like dogs would.
Exactly.
Only he's got a humanoid body, which is wonderful. But then in panel 3, you have both the dialogue balloons and the top of Kilowog's head break the panel border and cut into the above panel 2. So because those are encroaching on the space of panel 2, you're going to look at those images, see text and read it, and know that you're supposed to go down to the image of Kilowog because his head breaks into that panel 2 and makes it look like one continuous flowing image. And then he even goes further. You'll notice Kilowog in panel 3 has a hand outstretched because he's talking with his hands and demonstrating as he speaks. And the fingers on his left hand are cropping and breaking into panel 4. So you follow Kilowog's face, you read the dialogue from left to right, and you follow his fingers, which guide you smoothly and gently into panel 4.
That's genius. Now, the word balloons also assist, but that's got to be Bob LePan doing that part. But the word balloons assist the flow as well. But yeah, the way that is laid out, I never would even notice that I'm forced to read that way without ever missing a beat.
Well, the thing is, when you do it well, and Adam Hughes is doing a terrific job, you don't notice it if it's done correctly.
There you go.
And then we get to the bottom strip here, where we have an inset circular panel of Black Hand nearly choking on his drink when he notices the Martian Manhunter.
Mm-hmm.
So what we have is a large picture of John in the foreground and a silhouetted figure way in the background. And then the inset panel even creates an arrow from the border of the panel to signify like zooming in on a film camera to the silhouetted figure. And then we cut back to the table and we have the sound effect of it. And I just love the way that like you can feel the camera zoom in and zoom out. And you know, something crazy is about to happen when you turn the page.
Right. Absolutely.
Now you have the print version with you right now.
Yep.
Do you have to turn the page over to see page 17?
Yes, you do. In fact, it's page 16 is a left-facing page, but the right-facing page is an ad for a comic convention. So yes, you have to turn the page to get the big reveal of what we're about to see.
Oh, that's fantastic. Because another thing, I don't know what this is officially called. I call it the left-hand surprise. And it's where you're reading a comic and you specifically designate the pagination of the pages, meaning what's on the left, what's on the right, and deliberately set it up so that you have to turn the page to get to a surprise moment on the following page.
Yes, yes.
The perfect example of the left-hand surprise goes back to a personal favorite, JLA issue number 5 with the one punch. Because I believe in the print version of that one, you had to turn the page to get to the punch.
You might. I can't remember, but that sounds about right. I mean, Kevin McGuire definitely understood the ability to make force you to turn the page. Yeah.
Yes. And I remember hearing an interview with Neil Gaiman where he was talking about Sandman. I believe it was issue number 7, which is where Lord Morpheus has a showdown with Dr. Destiny. And there's a moment where we're supposed to believe that Dr. Destiny may have won, and it's an all-white background. And you turn the page and you realize the all-white background is actually the white skin of Morpheus's palm as he holds a tiny Dr. Destiny in his hand.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the issue, and they even reprinted the pages, I think in the paperback, you have to turn the page. They reprinted some of the artwork and replicated it to make an additional page that wasn't scripted, just so you had to turn the page and see that image of Morpheus on the left. So it was a surprise.
That's wonderful when they maintain that continuity of page left, right, you know, left, right pagination. That's great.
Yes. Now, there's this weird moment on page 19 where we have Kilowog slapping one of Black Hand's goons, and for some reason, the sound effect is flipped.
Now, I'm going to jump in here because this is also in my notes. I love this. Yeah, so Kilowog is doing a backhanded slap. He's doing a backhanded slap at the guy. And so the onomatopoeia, which is schlump, is also written backwards because it's a backhand. It's very clever. That cracked me up.
Oh, my goodness. Wow, that's so cool. I do notice that the other onomatopoetic sound effect letterings all have motion to them. So the womp in panel 1 moves in the direction of the guy getting womped.
Mm-hmm.
And the scrump in panel 2 has this nasty sting on the S to indicate how violent the chair bash that's happening to that thug really is.
Right.
Now we get to page 20. And we see Fire returned back from her night out on the town.
Actually, I'm going to call you on this one.
Oh?
Because I have the digital version. I can look at it very closely. And underneath that towel is white hair.
Really?
Yeah. Now, I'll check my print version to see if it's green hair. But in the digital version, yes, I believe that is white hair in the print version as well. I think that's ice. Now, the question, though, is the letter on her robe, is that a calligraphy F or a calligraphy I?
I don't know. I took it as an F, and I thought those wisps that look like hair was just a shadow on the underside of the towel that she has wrapped around her hair.
It could be. So we could go either way.
I prefer to think that that's fire.
It would make more sense. Yeah, it would make more sense if it was fire because we saw her earlier. You get your first bit and then the second bit. But I don't know.
And clearly she got a decent amount of bed rest that night because here she is. She has a towel wrapped around her head like she's freshly out of the shower. She's got a facial peel mask over her face right now, which is why it's so difficult for us to know if this is ice or fire. And she's wearing a bathrobe with an indeterminate monogram on it. And because I, too, with the digital version, can zoom in very closely on the image, notice that she's holding a coffee mug with a tea bag inside, because there's the little pull tab draped over the mug. And you can make out lettering that the coffee mug says best chest in the West.
Oh, my God. I couldn't figure out the second word. OK. And you know what? The face mask is green. So we're just going to say this is fire.
And I'd like to think that whatever she was doing that night when we were having dinner with Nort, that she earned a coffee mug.
That is officially decided. That is now canon.
Excellent. Now, as for the rest of the page, I love the way this is laid out, because that first panel, we have the perspective of the wall leading from left to right. So your eye is moving from the left side to go into the kitchen area. And then we're inside the kitchen with Booster and Beetle. And on panel three, we don't have enough room to show Booster, Beetle, and Elrond in the same shot, even though all three are interacting. So we have Elrond's shadow on the floor to indicate his placement in the room.
Mm-hmm.
It's fantastic stuff. And we get a great expression from Beetle on panel four. And then when we get to panel five, we're back out in the hallway where we saw fire, because I'm going to call it that was fire.
Yep.
And you notice we're going out the other side of the room. So you begin the page going to the left into the room, and you exit the page, leaving down the same hall, going off to the right side.
Wow. You did do a whole rotating camera 360 degrees across six panels. That's amazing.
I know. It's so good. Like I said, this comic could almost be a masterclass in storytelling techniques. There's so much that I just love about this.
I believe, and Tim Price will correct me if I'm wrong, I believe this is Adam Hughes' last issue of the JLI, at least during the Bwahaha era. So if he's going to go out, this is a hell of a way to go out.
It really isn't. I'm suddenly very sobered up. That's such sad news.
I could be wrong. I'm really good at being wrong. So I don't know. We'll see.
Let us know for sure, Tim.
He's already writing the comment. Don't worry.
Fantastic. All right. Now I'm going to cut to page 22. And I love the names for these ancillary characters. Dr. Kafka, Dr. Muggleopolis, Dr. Dinhofer.
Actually, it's Mr. Muggleopolis. And that why that's important is because Mr. Muggleopolis is the goon that has checked Black Hand into here. It's like one of his own goons. So his name is Mug. Yeah, Mr. Muggleopolis. So that's his goon.
You better pay his debt, so I'm going to send Mr. Muggleopolis after you.
Exactly. Now finish your thought, because I've got something to say about this page as well here.
Well, okay, so we got Dr. Kafka, Mr. Muggleopolis, Dr. Dinhofer. Makes you think that Dr. Herfensturfer must be in residence treating DCOCD next door down.
He might be. And with the patients, with what they're talking about, it would be a good place to do that.
Indeed. So we have found the location of the DCOCD clinic.
There it is. Oh, my gosh. Now, here is your Alfred Hitchcock moment. So the creators of this book include Andy Helfer, Kevin Dooley, Adam Hughes, and of course the other folks. But in the last panel, all three of them are here. In the straitjacket is Andy Helfer being carried away, ranting and raving about Batman. The person carrying him away is Kevin Dooley. And in the far right corner, the person with the pencil, in a single kind of a bluish gray color, is Adam Hughes himself. This was all confirmed by Adam Hughes on Twitter just the other day. I was chatting with him, and I only spotted Kevin Dooley and Andy Helfer. He pointed out himself that he's the one with the pencil in the picture.
And clearly Mr. Hughes is right-handed.
Looks like it.
Okay, so I know that Andy Helfer wrote Batman Annual number 14. Was he ever an editor on Batman?
I don't know. Denny O'Neill would have been the editor at this point. But I mean, you know, think about it. He does edit Batman here. Andy Helfer has been involved with a number of comics over the years. So I imagine he's been involved with Batman at some point. Or at the very least, we could say everybody goes through a Batman phase.
Yes. And this was 1991. It's a good year for a Batman phase.
Yes, it is. Oh, gosh. So I've got thoughts. I've got lots to say about the issue myself as well. I just, big picture wise, Nort is freaking hysterical in this issue. You know, since we started this podcast, there's been a little bit of a concern, you know, at what point did Nort become annoying, or is Nort annoying, or whatever? Because a lot of people aren't fans of Nort. And I got to tell you guys, this issue is the perfect amount of Nort. It's done expertly. There's never any point in the issue where you're like, okay, I'm done with this bit. It is done brilliantly. So I, hats off to JM DeMatteis and Keith Giffen for keeping the Nort perfect. I was hysterical.
So I had a thought that's very similar to that, that even though Nort is in the title of the issue, that he's well balanced between John Jones and Kilowog. So he's got these balancing figures with those two characters so that it's not an excessive amount. Just like you said, it's just Goldilocks right. You know, with Martian Manhunter around, that nobody's going to get seriously hurt. So as a reader, you can just sit back and just enjoy the wackiness as it comes.
And, you know, you mentioned the different characters that balance it out. I mean, really, this comes across, and I don't know if this is intentional or not, but it might have been because JM DeMatteis loves the Three Stooges a lot.
I hadn't thought of that.
I mean, Jean is Moe, Kilowog is Larry, and Nort is Curly. I mean, they really works if you go through it looking at it. I mean, they really, really, all it's missing is someone going, brruh, 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 you know, kind of thing.
Yeah, wise guy, eh?
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. That's what I was trying to do and failing miserably.
Slightly.
So it really does have that feel, and it's balanced across the three of them. They each have bits to play that are funny. They do all kinds of riffs. They do the riff on the old Saturday Night Live skit with Steve Martin, you know, the wild and crazy guys. They say three wild and crazy aliens. I mean, they play up that. I love the bit with Nort with Liberty the dog. There's just something so sweet about seeing him carry Liberty around, being, you know, two dogs, and the conversation that he has with him. He makes jokes about how Liberty's got an accent, which is hysterical. It's so fun. So fun.
But you got to figure Liberty's what, from the Bronx?
Probably. This issue was exactly what was needed after a long five-part General Glory story. I mean, there's a lot of laughs in the General Glory story, but it was one long focus story. And here you just get a completely wacky one shot that is just, it's the perfect, dessert after all of that.
Yeah, it's a palate cleanser.
Exactly right. Exactly right. You mentioned the Alf thing. We didn't really get a chance to say it, but there is a crack about Alf in here. They're talking about being aliens and being out and proud. And Kilowog yells, well, get with the program. Well, you could do the voice, but I'm going to say, get with the program, John Z. Those days are gone. Say it loud, brother. I'm an Alf and I'm proud. Now, this is, I got to think, 91. Alf's probably off the air by now, I would think. So having a reference to Alf is always a joy for me, though.
And on page 8, where Jean makes the comment about taking on a human appearance, mm-hmm. and he says, it's an old habit when I'm out among the crowds. Attitudes towards extraterrestrials were a little different when I first came to Earth. And you got to figure, if the Martian Manhunter stories date back to the 1950s,
yep.
then that is very delicately understated of Jean to say.
It really is. And you also, in the same issue, you get to see his, you know, what they call the Gumby alien form, which is something you don't see very often. So you get to kind of the whole gamut here of him talking about appearance and his fear of revealing his true self, and then him revealing himself as an alien in public. There's a lot of undercurrent there that I don't know that it's a deep psychological look, but you can see layers of Martian Manhunter and how he has to deal with different people.
And you notice on page 6, we get that 9-panel grid once again, which is kind of a hallmark. I just attribute my brain to Keith Giffen. Mm-hmm. That on the final panel, panel 7, that as Martian Manhunter is bursting out of his chambers, that his head is still morphing from Gumby to more traditional humanoid.
Yep.
And that we have Elrond placed just so to strategically cover any potential naughty bits.
Exactly right. So I've got to mention a bit, and it may come up again later, is on when they're coming back from the play, you described the hilarity of Nort ruining the play, right? But
yeah.
It's laid out so perfectly. And I read this in panel by panel mode. So the way this lays out, as you read it panel by panel, and the fact that I couldn't see the final panels, what makes it work. So Jean is just, he's had it. He is so mad at Nort. They're storming out of Broadway.
Yep, he's got his hands balled into fists.
And he is outraged at Nort's behavior. Now, we still don't know what Nort did, but he is outraged his behavior. Then they get in the cab. Little bits, drips and drabs start coming out about how Nort, he tortured the cast. He got him thrown out of the theater. He leapt up out of the audience. He scared somebody who fell in the orchestra pit. And you're thinking, oh my gosh, what did Nort do? And then the final panel is when they're driving away and they reveal the cat's logo. And they don't even hang a lantern on it. You got to find the joke yourself and go, he's a dog. And that's cats. That's brilliant. So I think that was expertly done. Though, and again, that's probably down to Keith Giffen, really, but on the layouts. But either way, the way it's just rolled out slowly to get to that punchline is expertly done.
But the logo of the cat's eyes is visible in panel one, but it's obscured by the dialogue balloons.
Yeah, you'd never pick up on that unless you really, really were thinking about it. Yeah, it's only in hindsight that you could see that.
On panel three of page 10, the page that you're describing right now, very human-looking Nort. I wonder if that was based off of a photo reference, and further, if that was a photo reference of Art Carney.
I'm not sure. I would hope so. I love the style that he did with this, like the way Nort's shirt's just a bunch of series of lines. Mm-hmm. The way that, and now the color has stepped in here too, with single colors. You know, way making the street lamps make everything kind of a sickly yellow. It's a really great panel.
Just that one image of Nort right there just looks so natural. Mm-hmm. And just I wonder if either that was based on a photo or somebody posed for that.
I don't know.
The bottom panel there, mm-hmm. panel four, looks like it's a treated photograph.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure that's a photo stat that they've done some Zip-A-Tone on top of, is what it looks like, with the cabs and everything. Looks like.
Yep. Oh, Jack Kirby used to love doing that stuff in the late 60s.
Yes, he did. And there's lots of little things. I mean, like on page two, panel five, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but there's a great bit where Martian Manhunter's talking to Elrond, and on the screen behind him is the video surveillance footage of Nort. But, you know, Adam Hughes took the time to make Nort picking his nose. I mean, just silly bits like that. There's great bits with Martian Manhunter saving Norton Blackhand as they're falling. The action looks great. You know, and just from a story perspective, the whole idea of Blackhand being brought back from issue 28, which at this point was, 2 years ago, probably, or so? And they bring back the joke about his hero phobia, and it's hysterical. I mean, the joke lands. It works. It's hilarious.
And see, with that comic I was mentioning earlier, Superfluous City, I want to do a comic of just that. Like people having superhero anxieties and having a mental clinic specifically for that. I think that's a great concept.
That's awesome. That is absolutely fabulous. All right. Well, I think it's fair to say we both are absolutely in love with this comic. Now, guys, if you go back and listen, again, plug for myself, in November, there was also an interview with J.M. DeMatteis where we talked about his new Kickstarter, but he also talked about JLI. He specifically called out this issue as being one of his favorites. He loves this issue, and I can see why. It's an absolute hoot. I did not know what to expect going back into this because I had not reread it in 30 years, and I absolutely loved it. And it sounds like, Jonathan, you did as well.
Oh, yeah.
Well, now comes the tough part. This is where we are going to have to nominate the
Pwahaha Award.
Folks, this is where both myself and Jonathan will pick one moment, and only one will be awarded the coveted Pwahaha Award. Jonathan, you're the guest, so you get to nominate your pick first.
Oh, let me crack my knuckles here. All right, so my nominee for the Pwahaha Award has to go to page 17. We just discussed that you have to turn the page to get to that image, but Blackhand diving with murder in his eyes towards John Jones, screeching like a banshee. And we have, if you look in the background, there's a waitress who's diving out of the way and she's upturning her tray, which is causing a plate of what looks like pasta to sploosh into the face of either the maitre d'. Actually, he's got the towel over his hands. I think what that is probably the dump-smacking waitress.
Okay.
And so she gets reprimanded by her boss. And then when Blackhand goes diving through the restaurant, she ends up throwing a bowl of spaghetti into her boss's face in the background. And then, I mean, it just builds. So we get John in this dialogue balloon with tiny, tiny little words to indicate he's muttering under his breath, "Why does this not surprise me?" And then we get Nort, who's in the shadow of the diving, murderous Blackhand, going, "Wowzer, these autograph hounds sure are enthusy." And before he can say ick, Nort and Blackhand go crashing through what turns out to be a very high window. And then when you think it can't get better, then we have the final panel where an exasperated and just at his wit's end, John Jones is like, Nort, you come back here this instant. So I'm giving the Bwahaha Award to Black Hand and to John Jones.
That is a really good nomination. And I will tell you, when I was reading this, I gasped and muttered out loud when they smashed through the window, knowing how high up they were and that Nort didn't have his power ring. And my wife, even across the room, said, what? What's wrong? I said, you know what? It would be too difficult to explain it to you. I said, I can if you want, but it's going to be like a 20-minute treatise. And she's like, no, thank you. So it is a great moment. It really is. It is one of the standout moments of the issue. It does build towards the end. It is not the moment I picked, so we're going to have a little bit of debate here. I picked the single page of page 10, which I described earlier, which is the Cats' revelation, how they come out of the Broadway play. Martian Manhunter has had it. He is calling it a night. He is so pissed off at Nort. He's raging at him. And again, through the dialogue and then with the visual punchline, you're slowly getting doled out what Nort did, what he disrupted, and then that joke at the end that you got to put together yourself, that he's a dog and he disrupted Cats. I just laughed hysterically about that for a couple of days. That cracked me up. So it's tough. I'll tell you, that's a tough choice. I'll give you a second to say your bit, and then I'll share my thoughts. You go ahead.
All right. Well, the thing with humor, it's subjective. And when I was reading this issue just for review to prepare for this recording, I literally bwahaha'd and burst out laughing when I turn the page and there's Black Hand tilted at an action angle with his hands in claw formation. It's like I'm laughing now just looking at it. And the fact that it has this background continuity going on with the bubblegum chewing waitress and her maitre d', and that it's just a joke that builds. But the Cat's joke builds as well. The thing is, that one builds to a specific punchline. And this one starts funny on the page and just builds on top of that. Panel one's fun. Panel two, panel three, panel four. Just every panel gets funnier. That's my pitch.
And my response is going to be, yeah, we're giving it to Black Hand and Martian Manhunter because it's that damn funny. It really is. It also leads to the action moment of the issue. I can't deny that because, you know, every comic's got to have some kind of superhero action, right? So it leads to that. The expressions, I mean, even if you go forward to page 18, the last panel where Martian Manhunter's flying away with Black Hand and Nort, just that last panel of Nort with his eyes, he looks hollow. He looks shaken. His ears are flapping. You know, one of his eyes is covered by one of his ears. It's hysterical.
Black Hand is drooling out the corner of his mouth.
Yes. So congratulations to Martian Manhunter, Black Hand, and Nort. You have won the coveted Bwahaha Award. Please wear it with pride. It is as tangible as the laughter we give you. All right. Now, Jonathan, I need to ask a favor. Would you mind hanging out here for a bit to make sure that Elrond actually pays Booster Gold on that bet that they made? Because quite frankly, I don't trust anyone with money that used to work for MangaCon.
Oh, and you trust Booster Gold with money?
Good point.
Yeah, honestly, I ought to claim that $20 myself just to cover the trouble of babysitting those two.
That seems fair. Good luck. You know what? When we bring you back at the end, you can let me know how that worked out for you.
Maybe I can get that adjusted for inflation. I'll be back.
Folks, yes, Jonathan will be back. Right now, though, we are going to go to a podcast promo break. And when we come back, I'm going to head over to the London Embassy for the 27th issue of Justice League Europe.
Maybe it's a voice.
I will soon know. Can you home in on it? We all hear that, Lander.
I really think we should worry about the hearing now.
All right, well, I found the quadrant.
Oh, God.
All I want to know is what is it?
Podcast.
Doesn't sound like any radio signal, huh?
Dark Horse presents Aliens.
I don't understand this.
Content.
All we know is that the xenomorph may be involved.
Excuse me, sir. A what?
What exactly are we dealing with here?
Comic book adaptations of 20th Century Fox intellectual property.
How many different ways do you want me to tell the same story? I got into trouble. My ship, there was an accident. We found an alien creature. It was very dangerous.
Spoilers.
A creature that gestates inside a living human host. These are your words. And has concentrated acid for blood.
That's right. We sat down there on company orders to get this thing, which destroyed my crew and your expensive ship. When they first heard about this thing, it was crew expendable. The next time they sent in Marines, they were expendable too.
We don't have a lot of time, okay?
Oh, God, what are we listening to? Idiot!
Hey, what, has anybody else got a better idea? How long would it take you to do that?
20 minutes to an hour.
About 2 hours.
More like 2 or 3 with that.
We have been here for 3.5 hours.
I read your deposition, and it's great. If you just stick to that, I think we'll be fine.
Oh, I really hate to point this out, but it might be better off without oxygen.
Well, whatever the hell it is, we gotta catch it.
Look, man, I only need to know one thing. Where they are.
Did IQs just drop sharply? We homed in on its beacon.
This has been the Roald Stein Podcast.
We have it on disc, so you better look at it.
Okay, put that on the screen for me.
Now move it, people!
Why don't you just check out
the Dark Horse Presents Aliens Podcast?
Because I don't have to. Do you mind?
They think we're crud.
That could have been better.
Are you finished?
And now, our coverage of Justice League Europe number 27. For break, and I'm here with our second co-host for this episode. This guest is a massive fan of Power Girl. In fact, he's gunning for the top fan award against Symbol Pending, to the point where he obsesses, and I mean obsesses, about the pronunciation of Power Girl's Kryptonian name. Yeah, people, some people lose sleep over this. He even forced me to ask Jerry Conway and Paul Kupperberg whether it's, you ready for this? There's three different pronunciations I had to choose from. Was it Kara? Kara or Kara. So, geez, a little pushy, I think. So, folks, please help me welcome Mr. Pushy himself, Mr. John Coos. Welcome to the London Embassy, John. Thanks for being here, man. How you doing?
Hey, man. Thanks. Super happy to be here. I'm doing fine. A little tired. Just got back from Vegas. Big, long soccer tournament with my son.
Woohoo!
But they won.
Awesome.
Pretty awesome. And I'm stoked to be here.
That's congratulations to your son. That's fantastic. Playing in Vegas, that's got to be amazing. Oh my gosh.
Well, for the parents, it was too.
I was going to say, did you miss a match because playing the slots?
There's been a few parents that have missed the first game the next day after acting like children the night before. But no, it's a great team. Great fun. Yeah, it's cool.
Awesome. Well, I'm so glad to get you on the show because, I mean, obviously, as you long-term listeners know, John has been listening to the show since day one, right, John?
Actually, yes, I have been. No, I haven't. I actually found this podcast back in like January of this year. We're talking 2022, people, because there's going to be a John Coos 5 years from now who needs to know what we're talking about. And I powered through them all, through dog walks and driving, probably in like 2 months, which is crazy. And then I went straight into the Who's Who podcast.
Woohoo!
And I burned through all of those, except for maybe the Legion ones.
What? You skipped a... Ugh. We did our best to keep it interesting. We really did.
Well, since I've caught up on everything, I should go back to them, right?
You had to cover 7 issues, and we did it in 3 episodes, so I tried not to prolong the pain to anyone.
Well, I love it. I'm glad to be here, man.
Well, this is super exciting. You've really put yourself out there as a massive Power Girl fan. you're gunning Symbol Pending for that job, so we'll have to have a face-off someday, maybe. And so, all right, so let's talk about this. So you pushed me in a corner here to reach out to Jerry Conway and Paul Kupperberg and ask about the pronunciation. And what did we get? What was the answer?
Well, it's definitely not Kara. We know that much. I still think that mine's pretty close. I say Kara. I think you're interpreting their response as Kara or something. But let's go with Kara. No. And the reason why is because, as I was telling you before, when we were doing a little the green room stuff earlier, when I was a kid in the 70s, I was reading a lot of Superboy and Superman's girlfriend, Lois Lane, that I kind of got from my uncle. and Kal-El's mother is Lara. That's how I read it.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I got discovered, you know, I discovered Power Girl, I immediately just thought that Lara and Kara rhymed. That's been in my brain since the 80s.
You know, that may be the mental crutch I start using, because I can't, no matter how many times I've been told to do it correctly, I can't get it right. I really can't, because I used to work with a lady named Kara, and for many, many years, and that just rolls off the tongue with me. I wanted to name my daughter Kara at one point. Mm. My wife nixed that when she figured out it was Supergirl's real name. But either way, I will use Lara Kara from now on to try and get me there. That'll probably last 5 minutes, by the way.
It's tough to deprogram, man. For sure, for sure, for sure. Hey, man, is this the part of the podcast where I pretend to know you well enough to where I can just like randomly insult you?
Yes.
I've noticed that the previous guests, they do that. So here it goes.
Okay.
I really question your sanity for having Blue Devil as your favorite all-time character, man. I mean, as a matter of fact, dude, I just picked up Fury of Firestorm number 24, his first appearance,
yes,
in a dollar bin a couple days ago. Your favorite character is a dollar bin character, bro.
To be fair, my favorite character is a quarter bin character, really, to be honest. But he's also one of like my top five, really. It's Aquaman, Firestorm, Blue Devil, Dr. Fate, who you should appreciate, and then the fifth spot's kind of rotating. But either way, that's where my true love is. So I spread it around a bunch of 50 cent bin characters, actually.
Well, anyway, that was my best shot at a contrived insult, bro. Did I do a good job?
I feel like it worked well. I feel like the people at home might actually believe we've been friends for 30 years, and you're just doing the bada bing sort of moment there. That's good. And I've also noticed guests, when they come on the show, they seem to take a lot of joy, and that's, of course, what I want them to do, is find the joy, in insulting me. They seem to find joy in insulting me. So who am I to stand in the way of their happiness?
Well, but the truth is about this podcast, and I'll be completely sappy and serious about it. I've really latched on to your find my joy mantra, man. Like I started looking at things through a find my joy sort of prism, and it's actually kind of made me more content with my geekiness and the things I like to do. So thank you, man.
Well, I'm glad if I played any small part. I mean, certainly I'm not the person who sort of originated the idea of do stuff that makes you happy, but I'm glad if my preaching that has helped in any way. Because, I mean, I spent a lot of years as an angry fanboy. Unfortunately, some of it behind a microphone. You can find those podcasts where I was an angry man. And eventually I just got to the point where I'm like, you know what? I'm doing this to enjoy myself. This is my escape. Why should I get mad? And so that's kind of where I am now.
I totally agree, man. Like, and I posted something recently on Facebook about DC, something I like. Maybe it was just your podcast that I reposted, just so you'd mention my name, yo. And some random dude from my high school goes, DC sucks, Marvel rules. I'm like, what the hell,
bro? My God.
Why? I go, you know what? Marvel does suck, but you know what? I'm not going to say it out loud.
I think there's room in my heart for both, but
I'm kidding. But yeah, dude, my problem with Marvel is if I start reading Marvel, I will buy everything for the last 40 years. I can't do it. I can't.
Right.
That's my personality, you know?
Well, that's the comic collectors and the comic companies count on that. You know, they count on the fact that we're all obsessive compulsive about having the complete run, or, oh my gosh, I can't have that one missing issue, or I've got to get that crossover. By the way, you should pick up Lazarus Planet or whatever the heck it's called coming up in a couple months. Right, John?
Right on, because Power Girl's in it.
And Firestorm's coming back too, apparently. So that's another way they're trying to hook us and try to get our money.
Maybe
so.
They should hook up.
That, you know, you know the history there, right?
I should.
Firestorm and Power Girl? Dude, okay. So there's an old blog that this total nerd used to run called Firestorm Fan.
Okay.
Yes, that was me. Right. Just Google firestormfan.com and search for Power Girl. And I put together a whole post all through the Justice League of America issues. Every time the JLA and JSA got together, Firestorm and Power Girl were flirting hardcore. Like, they were like about to hook up. Jerry Conway was purposely trying to put the youngest members of each team together. And so this went on for a couple years till finally she snubs him. And then the story just kind of drifts away. But I'll send you a link later, but there's a lot of this. And some of it's George Perez artwork. I mean, it's good stuff. So yeah, there's definitely a history of Firestorm and Power Girl.
I'm going to have to reread those, you know, and sometimes when you read things the first time, you know, you don't pick up on stuff. That's what's cool about rereading stuff, you know? It's like, oh, damn. I didn't see that happen the first time, you know?
Well, this whole podcast is that for me, because I mean, I don't remember reading these things 30 years ago. And like the Starro storyline, I remember it existed. I couldn't remember anything about it. And so like this, to me, reading this issue felt like it was brand new. So I loved it.
Yeah, no, totally, man.
Now, speaking of JLA or JLI, I should say, and reading it and discovering it, what about you, man? So what's your origin story with the JLI? How'd you find the book? How'd you fall in love with it?
Yeah, man, it was kind of like one of the greatest accidents of my life. Let's just put it that way. So in full disclosure, I'm almost 53 years old, graduated in 88. So it was the summer after I graduated, went to see my grandma. I live in Southern California with my mom and sister in Kenosha, Wisconsin, you know, future side of political unrest, but let's not get into that. And we were on our way back, had this crazy layover in Minneapolis. So we're like stuck in the airport for like 3 hours because, you know, my mom always bought the cheapest, crappiest flights on the crappiest airlines. That was like built into our travel. So I'm in this airport.
I still do that, by the way, but okay, go ahead.
Yeah. And strangely enough, I mean, it wasn't like a Walden Books or anything. It was some kind of like, I don't know, Joe's bookstore thing. They would never have that in all the spiffy new airports of today. But there was a bookstore that had old comic books in it, or not, you know, semi-old, like, you know, within the last year or two. Mm-hmm. And I was done playing with color forms. I didn't have a, you know, phone or anything. I was bored. You know, people our age remember, like, wow, if you don't have stuff with you, you got no phone, you'd be bored.
Exactly.
So anyway, I discovered these JLI issues on the shelf, and I think they're like 50 cents each. And my mom, you know, said, yeah, fine, whatever, buy them. You're driving me crazy. You know?
Right.
And I think I bought like five or six or seven of them or whatever. And the earliest one was JLI number 8, Moving Day.
Oh, perfect.
And, which is kind of a cool one to start with if you don't start with number 1 in a weird way, because it grabs you like, what the hell is this? Like, they're literally just like hanging out and moving and shit, like, you know. And so anyway, after that, I was hooked. I went, you know, to a comic book shop, and I found out there was such a thing called pull lists, and I bought the back issues. I think I couldn't find number 4 or something for a while, but that's my JLI history, man.
That's awesome. I love the road trip origin, because like I have one like that too. I was reading Firestorm at the time. Back, I went to a trip to Michigan in 85, 86, and we stopped at a drugstore on the way, and I had nothing to do in like a 13-hour car ride. So I picked up in the drugstore Crisis on Infinite Earths number 6 and number 8, and changed my life forever, you know? And I love those kind of stories.
Yeah, man, that's sometimes things like play out in life, you know. It's just like I said, it was a greatest accident, you know. Now I got 25 long boxes of DC and all these omnibuses, and it's cost me a fortune, but it's something. It all started there, man.
That's fantastic.
All of it.
That's awesome. And he was showing me, by the way, before we started getting going, with his omnibuses. It's gorgeous collection you've got there, man. It's absolutely fantastic. I'm horribly jealous, and you have to send me your address later so I can break in and steal all of it.
No problem. Will do.
Well, let's get into this. So this is Justice League Europe number 27, published by DC Comics, cover dated June 1991, on the shelves April 30th, 1991. Cover price is $1 for shiny quarters, and the cover is by Bart Sears. And it's a pretty one. You want to tell us about it?
Absolutely, man. So you have the Justice League Europe logo on the top and the words Face Off emblazoned on the bottom. And boy, what a face off it is. On the right side of the cover, you got Metamorpho, Captain Atom, and Rocket Red squaring off against JLE members Flash, Power Girl, No Silver Here Sorceress, Elongated Man, Blue Jay, and Kilog, all with Starro starfishes on their faces. A character in silhouette, also affixed with a Starro, also lurks in the background, and I'm 99% sure that's Martian Manhunter.
Spoilers.
Yeah, well, it's on the cover, bro. Okay. And so, anyway, Captain Atom looks a little unfazed with Starro Elongated Man's head lunging toward him. Starro Kilowog had the presence of mind to put his workman's cap back on, which I believe would have fallen off once the Starro flew onto his face, but hey, you know what? Good for him.
Yeah.
And then Rocket Red, not Starroed, despite having a helmet on, hiding his facial expressions, looks surprised by Bart Sears cleverly placing a little floating accent mark above his eye slit of his Apocalypse armor, not the previous ridiculous boxy suit you love so much, Shaq.
It is so amazing, the original suit. But anyway.
God.
Debate for another day.
It's a debate for another day, but when I heard you say that, you know, 30 issues ago, episodes ago, I was like, come on, dude. It's ridiculous. Anyway, go on.
It looks better.
Let me carry on. So, Starro Blue Jay has a mini Starro on his face. You know, cute touch. In contrast to the cover of JLE 26, where in the group shot, Blue Jay's affixed Starro is full size. I guess the Starro shrinks when Blue Jay shrinks. Not sure. Whatever. And lastly, Power Girl looks hot, as usual, even with a starfish on her face.
You're not wrong there.
Yeah.
Now, I'm gonna disagree with you about one thing. You said Ralph stretching his neck, and you said Captain Adam is not he's non-flushed, right? I think Captain Adam's actually leaning back. Like, I feel like he's got his shoulders arched back and he's kind of pulling his head backwards. That's what it looks like to me.
Yeah, he is looking. He has got his head pulled back, but he doesn't look like alarmed.
No, just a little, just moving physically back a little bit.
He's kind of maybe like, it's Ralph with a starfish on his face. I don't know. he's still not scary.
Right, exactly. Right. It's a red-haired dork.
Yeah.
Metamorpho looks totally badass. He's got these huge, like, incredible Hulk-sized fists, and his hands are just huge. You know, that Bart Sears face that he does with Metamorpho, I absolutely love that.
Yeah.
Here's two interesting things that, I read the digital as well as the physical copy. So I've got my physical copy here. I'm reading the digital copy as well. A couple different things. One is, on the digital copy, they've actually erased that accent mark off of Rocket Red's head. The one that you just mentioned, the one that Bart Sears put on there to show his surprise. They actually erased that, which obviously I think was a huge mistake. They shouldn't have done that, but they did it for the digital. And then on the digital, you can get a better look at Blue Jay's. I know you're looking at the physical copy, right?
Mm-hmm.
So look at Blue Jay's chest. Do you see that kind of brown stuff right there?
Yeah.
On the digital copy, it's even clearer. It's just like a big brown smear. Like the colorist, I guess they just didn't know what to do, but it's just like a big brown blark all over his chest. It looks bizarre.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I was wondering if this little speck that this accent thing was like something smudged on my thing. So I Googled it and looked it up, and it's on the, you know, on the internet as the way it appears here.
Yep.
I couldn't reference, I got the omnibuses volumes 1 and 2, but this story is beyond volume 2.
Right.
And,
yeah. We're just barely beyond it. Exactly.
And I hope that they someday put that out, because I just love the quality of the pages in those omnibuses. But yeah, that's funny. I don't know. Have you seen that before where like the digital like corrected something? Because that kind of bums me out because it's not authentic.
I've seen them correct word balloons before. Huh. But I've never noticed, or at least that I can remember. I mean, you know, it's always possible I said something on a podcast 4 years ago that I've forgotten. But right. I don't remember them correcting the artwork. I remember them correcting word balloons before. So it is disappointing that they did that. Because you're right. I've got the physical copy. And you can clearly see that accent mark there.
Yeah, yeah.
Other interesting things, like Silver Sorceress, she's the only one with an eyeball peeking out behind the starfish, whereas last cover you could see almost everybody's eyeballs. So that's just of note. And then I do think Power Girl and Flash, and I already mentioned Metamorpho, they do look particularly awesome. They really, really do. And this will come into play in a minute, but I might as well mention it here. So last episode, you guys hopefully listened to the interview with Bart Sears. And Bart Sears was absolutely amazing.
Yep.
And he mentioned how he would draw Power Girl very, very chesty. Mm-hmm. Then Andy Helfer would come behind him and erase the bust line and make it smaller. Mm-hmm. Well, as we get into the issue, clearly Andy Helfer wasn't erasing anything on the inside of this book. But I suspect he erased something on the cover, because Power Girl's much more demure on the cover than she is inside. So I imagine that this cover was altered, I think. I don't know. Would you agree?
Yeah, maybe between the cover and the first page, she made another trip to the doctor, because it's and I loved on the Bart Sears interview, which was awesome.
Oh, thank
that
you.
That he, I think he was trying to just kind of riff on the whole what Wally Wood was doing.
Yes,
with all
he even said
comics.
That. Yep,
that was awesome.
Yes,
that is so cool. Like an homage to Wally.
Exactly.
Cool.
So the other thing to mention here too is that the cover here if you're not looking at an image of it, maybe you're driving your car, please don't be looking, you know, at the internet while you're driving. It's got kind of the challenge of the Super Friends face-off with the two groups coming together. And this trope goes back way before Challenge of the Super Friends, but that's always my favorite one. You know, it goes back as far as Justice League of America 56, all the way back to 1967. They have a great cover of the Justice League running at the Justice Society. So, you know, and I'm sure there's ones prior to this, but that have a similar motif, but I was just thinking Justice League one. So there's other ones, obviously, like there's one where they're fighting the Freedom Fighters, there's one where they're fighting a bunch of animals carrying machine guns. But yeah. Anyway, this trope repeats over and over in the Justice League. And interestingly enough, I did see online someone suggested that this cover was a riff on X-Men number 100. Because that cover had the, you know, the original X-Men facing off against the Uncanny X-Men, but in the centerpiece was Professor X. And then, you know, and that there may be something to that, because we do get the centerpiece of Martian Manhunter in silhouette on this one. So maybe it is more about the X-Men than about Justice League. I'm not sure.
What is this X-Men you speak of?
Hey, Marvel was my training ground to become a comic fan, so I will never diss Marvel. I love me some X-Men. Still to this day, I love X-Men.
I see, that's the kind of stuff I love about this show. I would never have picked up that sometimes covers are homages or honoring comic book art from 30 years earlier, and it's awesome. I never would have thought of it.
Well, tell you what, just for that, I will go ahead and throw these on the image gallery. So if you want to see these other covers, Justice League of America number 56 and 108 and 132 and X-Men 100, I'll throw all those on the image gallery just so you guys can kind of see the comparison. You guys can decide at home for us.
Right.
Let's get into this thing, man.
Okay.
All right, on the inside, plot and breakdowns by Keith Giffen, script by Gerard Jones, penciler is Bart Sears, inker is Randy Elliott, letter is Bob LePan, colorist is Gene D'Angelo, assistant editor is Kevin Dooley, and editor is Andy Helfer. The issue itself is called The Vagabond King. You want to start us off?
I will. In our last issue, our heroes discover a badly injured Starro who tells them that a meteor shower damaged his ship. He wants them to be kind and fix his ship so he can go home. Kilowog does that, but shortly after liftoff, the ship explodes. The JLE are bummed out a little and head home. Little did they know that the explosion released a shit ton of mini Starros over London. Our issue opens up with a splash page of the JLE coming home to the embassy unaware of the Lundo Starro infestation. Power Girl muses, pretty humiliating, spending half a day trying to convince an English country mob that you didn't mean to blow up their beloved interstellar starfish. There is some other light banter, but the most compelling aspect of this page is Bart Sears' accentuation of Power Girl's positives, if you catch my drift. Wally West, who doesn't speak a word on this page, has his right hand on Power Girl's shoulder, and I believe she's shooting a look at him of annoyance, you know, because of how much she likes him already. On page two, banter continues, and they observe that the embassy is oddly quiet. Then Power Girl's cat roars and runs off. It actually says roars, and Metamorpho nearly implies that the cat should be put down. But he reverses course when PG's pissy side comes out. She shoots him a pretty hard look, bro. Then Captain Atom notices Inspector Camus hiding in the corner. He tells the captain, shh, and states, they're everywhere, everywhere. Captain Atom, being bilingual, states to Silver, even though I don't wear any silver sorceress, in Pig Latin, I think our Interpol friend is AZ Cray, but quickly concludes that something must have spooked him. They casually head to the monitor room to discover that Catherine Colbert and Sue Dibney have Starro starfishes on their faces.
No! Creepy.
Starro Catherine says, why so shocked, Captain? We're all with Starro now. And Starro Sue finished the sentiment with, just as we were always meant to be. Then Dimitri, looking off-panel, exclaims, oh, Lord, my wife, my children. We turn the page and find what I believe is the creepiest panel in all the JLI books. Dimitri's wife and kids all Starroized.
Mm.
But perhaps even creepier, his wife is holding a serving tray of Starros as if she's about to serve them for high tea. We are in London, you know. The starfish fly off the serving tray and affix themselves to the faces of Flash, Power Girl, Elongated Man, Kilowog, Blue Jay, and Sans Silver Sorceress. Captain Atom, Rocket Red, and Metamorpho are unaffected due to their lack of skin, apparently. Well, Dimitri has human flesh, but it's neatly safe behind his apocalyptic armor and not that ridiculous boxy red armor that
you love
so much.
Oh, my Lord.
I'm sorry. It had to be said again because no one's ever really challenged you on it, man. All right. Then the Starro JLE attacks the non-Starro JLE, urging the non-Starro JLE to hurt them. In fact, Starro Wally West, channeling his BDSM non-Starro self, says, "Hit me, hurt me, kill me." Our Starros can't fight back without risk of harming their Starroized friends, so Captain Atom barks, "Pull out!" to Rex and Dimitri. As they fly off, they realize that the poor Londoners all have starfishes on their faces. They spot one poor sap running from a mob of Starro Limeys, but he too succumbs to their starfish fate. Then Starro Inspector Camus shows up with a couple Starro cops and opens fire. And as with the Starro JLE, they fly off again, but this time Captain Atom says, "Rein up," instead of "pull out."
So I'll take it from here. So Captain Atom, Rocket Red, and Metamorpho realize that they can't handle this themselves. So they fly to New York to recruit the JLA's help. Though I'm not exactly sure how Metamorpho got there as far as keeping up with Captain Atom and Rocket Red. I mean, doesn't he just like float like a gas, mostly like with the whim of the wind? I don't know. Anyway, so at the New York embassy, our European members are meeting with Martian Manhunter and Blue Beetle. Now, Beetle's over there cracking wise, of course, while Martian Manhunter takes a more strategic approach. So they spying electronically, our heroes determine that the Starro-controlled Catherine Colbert and Starro-controlled Sue Dibney, they were reviewing transportation timelines for ships, planes, trains, and trucks. I want to say planes, trains, and automobiles, right? But Starro's planning to quickly transport his starfish all over the world. So while Blue Beetle wants to go in guns blazing with the whole JLA, Martian Manhunter devises a covert plan of sneaking into London. So while Captain Atom, Metamorpho, and Rocket Red beam over using the teleporters, Martian Manhunter infiltrates the London embassy grounds by shapeshifting into shrubbery. Or maybe he's turning invisible. I'm not entirely sure which, but either way, he's there. So the Starro Control Kilowog sort of is dismissive of our heroes because he's more interested in studying the teleporters now that he's figured out what they're for. To fool the other Starros, Martian Manhunter shapeshifts into a middle-aged woman, and now with a Starro on her face, though it's not a real Starro, it's just part of John's disguise. So our heroes and John, they're now safe to walk the streets of London, and Martian Manhunter uses his telepathy to track down the specific Starro, that is, that contains the alien central consciousness, essentially the prime Starro. So our heroes follow this track, and they find themselves in the London sewers, where they can finally confront the prime Starro. It's a homeless man living on a cot in the sewers. So Jean and this prime Starro, they engage in this really brutal hand-to-hand fight. Jean, you know, is this middle-aged woman versus homeless vagabond. It's kind of in a gross way, sort of precursors the horrific trend of bum fights in the early 2000s, that horrible thing. So after a bit, though, Martian Manhunter finally transforms into his usual alien form. And the fight continues in all these shadows and silhouettes. And Martian Manhunter then literally smashes open the skull of the prime Starro vagabond. It's nasty. Rocket Red, Captain Atom, Metamorpho, they're horrified, right, at what Jean has done, his viciousness. Then the camera sort of does the big reveal, and we realize that the prime Starro is missing, and he's now affixed to Martian Manhunter's face. The prime Starro is in control of this Martian body that he calls a body of glorious, incomparable power. Next issue, Starcrossed. Oof, man. So what'd you think, buddy?
I loved it. I really did. It's pretty much got it all, you know. It's got a comedy, awesome art, and, you know, that fight scene at the end, like you mentioned, is some of the more brutal stuff, I think, in all the JLI books, don't you think? I mean,
yeah.
That punch was hardcore.
Oh, it was nasty, nasty. I was reading in panel by panel mode, which I absolutely adore. And you can come back on that in just a second. But so anyway, it's so brutal to get the zooming in on just how hard those fists are hitting. And whether it's Jean as a middle-aged woman or the vagabond kicking her in the chin. I mean, when you really zoom in on Bart Sears' art that's digitally restored so you don't lose all the line work, you know, the paper's not eating the beautiful ink, it's stunning and it's gross, that fight.
It is gross.
All right, go ahead. Let me have it about panel by panel mode. Bring it on, brother.
No. I mean, like a lot of things, you know, I get different perspectives. I tried it once a few years ago, and I realized what I thought was kind of like, this isn't how the original comic was supposed to be laid out, right? So like my geekdom, you know, I've been reading a lot about and listening to a lot of podcasts, you know, about why pages are laid out the way they are and stuff. And so I've kind of gotten away from the digital for that, at least the panel by panel, because I'm trying to respect the original, like, layout, you know, set forth by like Keith Giffens or whatever, you know?
I totally respect that. I do. Because the way I've got my panel by panel set up is when I flip the page, I see the whole page first.
Right.
Then I see panel by panel by panel. And when it's done, it shows me the full page again. So I actually see the full page at the beginning and the end. But in the middle, I get to study really closely the beautiful line work in those panels. And I'll tell you, what sold me on panel by panel was actually I was rereading Avengers Forever, drawn by Carlos Pacheco, who it's absolutely stunning. And every panel could have been a print. They were all so beautiful. And that's what sold me. And honestly, some of Bart Sears' work. I mean, this fight, if you were to look at these panels really closely, I mean, it's astonishing the work he puts into it. So
you make a convincing case, man.
Well, I think what we've solved is I'm right and you're wrong. So I think that's how that works.
I'll concede. Fine.
So tell me more. What did you like the most about this? Save it for the big award. But I mean, what else?
Yeah.
What's worth talking about here?
Some of my observations are as follows. During the melee between the Starro JLE and the non-Starro JLE, I was actually hoping to see Blue Jay shrink down and his Starro shrink along with him, like the cover, but he never shrunk in the comic. So I was like, mystery will never be solved.
You know what's weird about that is up till that moment, Blue Jay was tiny the whole time.
Like yeah.
When they're flying in, he's tiny. So he was tiny for a long time. So maybe the starfish did land on him small and he grew big. I don't know. Because it's actually led me to a question, which is with the starfish attached to Jean's face, when if Jean were to shape change, would that affect the Starro in some way? So anyway, something to think about.
But they just don't show him again.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. They don't show Blue Jay again. Yeah.
Yes. It's and I was looking hard, man. I'm like, is he in here? So actually, well, they don't show him small. They show him big, like you said. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, one kind of bummer about the issue is that like about halfway through, Power Girl's not seen again. That just friggin' sucks.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever. But whatever. And then the monitor screens, you mentioned it in your recap, like the ship and plane train schedules. It was a nice touch, I thought. I'm not sure if it was deliberate or not. The Star Princess. Well, sure, it was. Who knows? But the funny thing is, actually, it's an actual cruise ship. I've actually been on it. It's a Princess Cruise Lines, and we're kind of cruisers a little bit, me and my wife.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a Star Princess. So anyway.
Oh.
You know, but yet, you know, however, on the real Star Princess, the only thing resembling Starro infected cruisers were the people in the buffet line, man. I mean, it's like, I don't know if you've been on a cruise, but
yes.
Those folks kind of act like people infected by Starro, don't you think?
I think I was those people when I was on my cruise.
Yeah.
You know, that page, I discovered there's a typo on that page. So when it shows all the schedules, right? Four different ones. You see London, ship schedules, right? London Heathrow Airport, it says freight departures. That should say flight departures. Because freight is the next one for trains.
Oh, that is a typo.
Yeah, yeah.
That is interesting.
Well, I shouldn't say typo. It's a lettering mistake, I guess is what I should say.
Fair enough. I didn't pick up on that.
Yeah,
interesting.
Yeah.
See, there you go. The more times you read an issue, the more you'll discover.
Exactly.
Fair enough. Okay, and also, a couple more things. When you mentioned it, obviously in the recap, when our heroes are tracking down Starro in the sewer system and find Starro Prime sitting on a cot, I was like, was that cot in the sewer? Or did he like bring it down to the sewer? Like, why would there be a cot in the sewer? I don't know. It's possible, though, I suppose. You know,
I'm thinking the homeless guy, because I'm imagining this is where the homeless guy lived before Starro took him over. I don't think Starro's been hiding down here. I think this is where the homeless guy lived. So I think what happened was he had dragged a cot down there at some point and was living on it, because there's even a lantern, too.
Fair enough. And now let's just talk about that. And my last kind of big observation, I think, is the fight with John Jones and Starro Prime. You talked about it. I thought it was really, I think it was deliberate. I'm not sure that there was a couple panels where you can't see John Jones's face before it is discovered that the human host is dead. So I think we know that John Jones didn't kill the human, but I thought it was clever that there was a his head was we see the back of his head, so there must have been like the star must have jumped onto his face when we didn't see it. Does that make sense?
Yes, I totally agree. So on page 20, there's 9 panels because of course Keith Given, and around panel 6, Jean transforms from the middle-aged female back to his normal alien form. So, and then panel 7, he says, you know, that he's going at the starfish guy. So I think it happened around panel 8. I think where we're seeing the fisticuffs. In fact, there's one sound effect on an onomatopoeia for Chuck, C-H-U-K. That may be the sound of the starfish, you know, being chucked at his face. I don't know. But yeah, I think by the time we get to the last panel, panel 9, I think Martian Manhunter is definitely being possessed. Because even the human yells out, grah, right before he kills him.
Yeah. Right on.
So I've got a lot of thoughts. So in the very beginning, when they're walking down into the base, and this is just, it's not silly, but just an interesting observation. I love seeing the team walk. It sounds stupid, but you've got so many flyers on the team. Captain Atom, Rocket Red, Metamorpho, Silver Surfer, all of them can fly. And yet the only person flying is Blue Jay. So you just see them all walking down the stairs. And it just makes me think about, you know, like if somebody can fly, would they fly all the time or would they walk? And it makes sense that they're walking around because, I mean, that's just how as a race we generally get around. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I thought that was an interesting creative touch that the artist had to think about. How am I going to render these people? You know, there's no reason why Captain Atom couldn't hover down the stairs, but no, he shows him as a grounded, regular guy. So I think that was an intentional art choice.
Interesting.
Then when you jump forward to that horribly sad scene where the stars have now taken over London and our heroes, the unaffected ones, are on the rooftop and they have to watch that poor guy get Starro Limeys or whatever you called him? getting chased down. I mean, they have to sit there and just watch him be captured and be Starroed. And I mean, it's very sad. It's very touching. And Bart even put in a panel of Rocket Red. You can see a profile shot of through the armor. You can see Dimitri's face inside the armor. I don't think we've ever seen that before, and I don't remember seeing it again. You can see Dimitri's face, and he just looks so crestfallen as he's having to watch this happen.
Yeah. In fact, you know, that's kind of a theme that runs through this is like when they're fighting the Starro-ized JLE, they can't do, you know, Metamorpho and Captain Atom are arguably two of the most powerful people. They can't do anything, and they can't do anything with these Londoners either. I mean, there's kind of this helplessness among these guys on this whole thing.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about that, but that's a really good way. Because, I mean, when you're writing a story, you've got to find a way to challenge your heroes. And, you know, how do you challenge these guys in such a way? And mental powers are something they have no way to stop. And so, yeah, how do you challenge the strongest guys in the world? Throw mental powers at them. It makes perfect sense. So, they had to bring in Martian Manhunter to help with that. And you kind of hinted at it without necessarily saying it, but you say how Power Girl disappears in the second half of the issue. Mm-hmm. The back half of the comic, it kind of becomes the Martian Manhunter show.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they go to America. Martian Manhunter is the one who suggests they tap into the monitors and see what, you know, Catherine and Sue are up to. He's the one who comes up with a plan to infiltrate. He's the one that does the telepathy tracking him down. He's the one that fights the Vagabond. He's the star, and he's not really a regular in this book.
Right. No, it's interesting. And it made me actually think of something. I mean, and I apologize for not bringing this up earlier, but, you know, there's a line in here from when they're at the JLA embassy. Blue Beetle says, told you we'd wind up bailing you out. I couldn't remember if the JLA ever enlisted the help of the JLE, even in the Teasdale Imperative. Was it always the other way around? And so is Blue Beetle kind of right? Like, the JLE does fine on their own, but the JLA sometimes needs their help.
Teasdale, I think you're right. I think the JLE were there first because it was a European city. Right. And then... we'd have to ask Tim Price. Tim Price is our expert. He can probably tell us. But yeah, in my memory, I think you're right. I think the JLA's had to bail out the JLE more often. Huh.
Interesting.
Yeah. That's a bummer, huh?
Yeah.
Then two more observations. On page 13, there's a great shot in the JLA embassy when it's the gang talking together there with Martian Manhunter and Blue Beetle. And it's on page 13. It's the second panel. And it shows you a great size comparison between Metamorpho, Blue Beetle, Captain Atom, Martian Manhunter, and Rocket Red. And the way he's laid out the panel, it starts small because Metamorpho is all hunched over and upset. And it just, each character gets progressively bigger as far as you get to the right, which is really clever the way Bart Sears has done that. Mm-hmm. And it just shows how freaking huge Rocket Red is. You don't really get a chance to admire him often enough. And here, he just looks so incredible.
No, you're right. And this might be my time because I didn't get to do an in-stock trades thing.
He's real bitter about this too, folks.
I am going to push Human Target trade paperback. Well, actually, it's a trade hardcover. But the only reason I bring it up right now is because Dimitri's in it. No spoilers here, but he's depicted as huge.
Oh, great. Good. Good.
Yeah.
I've read the first issue, absolutely loved it, and I haven't read the rest. I've just been sort of waiting and getting distracted by other shiny things. Yes, I know the spoilers already. People, avoid the spoilers if you can. I can't wait to dive back in, though.
Yeah, no, totally. So, it's fun.
Question to ponder for you here. Mm-hmm. We both said a lot of nice things about this issue. I think we both love the art. We both love the action. However, I got to ask, you know, was this a treading water issue? And the reason I say this is, you know, ultimately, what really happened? You know, Starro took control of the league. We got three members on the run, but that's really kind of it. Now, I loved it. I enjoyed every bit of it, but I got to ask, was it padding?
I didn't perceive it that way. I mean, the previous issue was about Starro, and I didn't pick up on that myself. I really enjoyed the issue. It did have a kind of a leisurely pace a bit at times, but I kind of liked it. I really liked it, and I didn't feel that way at all.
And I'm going to say it's not also, because I'm going to say what this story is really about, and you mentioned earlier, is the powerlessness. I didn't have a way to put it into words until I'm stealing your words now, and I'll just say they were mine to start with, and when I'm done editing this, people will never know you had that suggestion. But yeah, it's a story of our heroes being powerless to help, and the emotional journey they have to go through that. So I think that's the core of the story. So I'm going to say it's not padding, even though not a lot fundamentally move the story forward. There's a lot of character and there's a lot of heart in this. And I'm going to stand by that.
Fair enough. And, you know, I think this is a negative, but just an additional observation of it's sort of in the Because Comics category. I sometimes wonder, like, as these Starros are flying off that plate.
Right. Right.
Wally West could see that a mile away.
Right.
You know, but, you know, it's comics, right? I mean, but it's, and probably Power Girl too. It's like, come on, especially Wally though, right? Who could anything catch Wally?
I love that you brought that up because that's one of my notes I forgot to write down, which is the Justice League, especially just like Europe, are made up of some of the most powerful people on Earth. And really, they should never lose a fight. They really, really shouldn't. And the only time that they're ever super effectual, effective, is when they're bad guys. Like the Flash, the minute he gets a Starro on his face, he is extremely competent. They can't stop him. He's kicking butt. Ralph is knocking Captain Atom over. You know, I mean, it's Silver Sorcerer is actually being useful. So, I mean, all these characters, you know, Blue Jay's actually a threat. I mean, all these characters are at their best and most powerful when they're controlled by bad guys, because when they're the heroes, they don't want to end the story so quickly, right? When they're the good guys, a comic writer could end every comic in three panels and go, well, Flash took care of that. So it's just kind of funny that we get to see Flash be very effective this time.
I totally agree. And actually, we didn't comment much on it, but that page or two, I guess it'd be like 7-8 when they're fighting and Wally does start kicking ass. That's some pretty fun action shit right there too, man. That was really fun.
Yeah. It was a good fight. It was fun. Like you said, it's only about two pages, but it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah.
And look at Ralph. Again, Ralph. Ralph's being awesome. That's crazy.
I know.
All right, so we are going to transition from this into our next segment where I get to sit back and make John do some of the work in something I like to call...
Character Spotlight.
And this is where we're going to ask John to share some thoughts on a particular character. We did Character Spotlight on this character a long time ago. It's Power Girl. But John's here. He strong-armed me. He pinned me to the ground, put my arm behind my back, and said, I'm doing a Character Spotlight on Power Girl, whether you like it or not. So I had to say yes. So please, tell us a little bit about Power Girl, whose name I believe is Lara Kara.
That's what I'm going with. Yeah, man. Yeah, you know, there's bound to be some repeats when you're doing this many issues. But yeah, let's cover her again. I mean, I appreciate it. I mean, as you know, Shag, and, you know, we've only known each other for a little while. I am the preeminent Power Girl fan. And to, Symbol Pending's total humiliation. Let's be honest, right? I mean, it's got a cool name though, but anyway, whatever. In fact, I'm on a quest to own all comics in which she has appeared on the cover, including all variants, even the ones that are like in her horrid headband costume.
Ooh.
So yeah, that's why we're going to talk about it. In fact, I just got a couple new 52 variants that of covers with her and Huntress that are really kind of weird, but
the world's finest costume.
The world's finest, yeah, that run, and it's like a couple variants where they're like in black and white and stuff like that. I mean, they were really reaching on those variants, frankly, but I had to have them. And so, you know, when did I fall in love with Power Girl? Well, actually, it was reading JLE, and I really wasn't familiar with her as I was only a casual comic reader prior to me stumbling into that bookstore in the Minneapolis airport. And so, you know, growing up, Shag, I've got to be, you know, honest, I was more of a Raquel Welch fan than a Shelley Long fan, if you know what I mean.
Okay. Yeah.
It's, you know, just kind of, you know, some guys like this or that or whatever. And I really took a fancy to Power Girl, and, you know, I wanted to know more. So I went to a local comic book shop and picked up Who's Who 18 and read her backstory, which is pre-Crisis, right? And it's the Earth 2 Kryptonian origin. They later what do they call those updates?
Yeah.
They turned it into the Atlantean thing, which is completely a mess.
Yeah.
But let's not go into that right now. And so also incidentally, because of that Who's Who, I learned that her first appearance was All-Star Comics 58.
Whoop, whoop.
And it wasn't the same shop. I went through this one in Newport Beach. I'll never forget it, right? You have these moments in your life. Oh, and like I found two All-Star Comics 58s for a whopping $1.50 and $3.
Oh, nice.
I know. Anyway, in fact, I had Jerry Conway sign one in a comic convention in Ontario just like 4 months ago, and I got a cool picture with it. I sent it to you.
Awesome. We'll put that on the gallery as well.
It's cool. Cool, man. So while reading the JLE, I always thought she was a Kryptonian and not a retcon distant relative of Aquaman or Arion or whatever.
What'd you think those symbols were on her belt and her cuffs?
I didn't think about it.
Because,
and this is what maybe Symbol Pending can help me out here. I don't think in this entire run they mention her Atlantean stuff at all. I could be wrong. Even when Superman operates on her, I don't think they mention anything about that.
During the Keith Giffen and JMD Mateus run, I'm pretty sure it never gets referenced. In some interviews with Giffen that I mentioned many, many months ago, Giffen specifically said, we're not touching the Atlantean origin stuff at all. We're just going to avoid it.
Well, good. I mean, because maybe my whole comic history or love for Power Girl would be completely different. I mean, if I found out she was an Atlantean ancestor of some kook named Arion, I might not have liked her. Despite my affinity for Raquel Welch type women. Anyway, but in fact, I mean, as you can see behind me, Shag, I have a shrine, a literal shrine to Jeff Johns for re-retconning her origin in Infinite Crisis back to her rightful Kryptonian origin. So
that was a brilliant move on his part. It really was.
And I'm rereading that run of JSA right now, and I could see him laying the groundwork for Infinite Crisis, for that reveal in Infinite Crisis, like 3 years earlier. He's laying the ground, which I think at that time, and I can't say that he's not doing it now, but whatever, Jeff Johns was really good at thinking way ahead, because he I think that's just something he did. I think it was great.
So, I'll tell you, in 2003, I was at Dragon Con at a panel. Jeff Johns was on the panel with a couple other folks, Greg Rucka and some other people. And he said on the panel that night before they had gone out to dinner, the comic writers, and had brainstormed a great crossover idea. And he said that he had made some decisions about who Power Girl really was, but we wouldn't find out for a long time, but we were going to love it. Now, it's possible his idea changed from 2003 to 2005, but I like to think that that was the Dragon Con where he decided that Power Girl was going to be Kryptonian.
Wow, that is cool. That is cool. And now, I don't want to digress too much, but there's been a couple times where I thought that he was going to do something. There was a time in New 52 where he had future Booster Gold observing the JLI, I think, or the JLE or Superman or something, and then he never came back to it. To be honest, but whatever. But yeah, I dig her, and she's evolved over the years. I mean, there was that whole thing about how angry she was and whether or not she was always just pissy and the Diet Coke and all this other stuff. Oh. But like, I think when rereading recently the Jerry Conway stuff from All Star Comics, he was doing his level best to create an independent woman that wasn't taking any guff from these guys, especially Wildcat and stuff. And I think Giffen and DeMatteis and the gang did their best to try to carry that forward. It sometimes it came across a little aggro, but I think she's a great character, and I'm glad she didn't get eliminated in Crisis. And I think DC's better for it.
And, you know, and I agree with just about everything you said there. And one of the nice things too is they never played her. Well, I shouldn't say they never played her for laughs, but they played her as the quote unquote straight man. She was the one who wasn't cracking jokes. She was the one that everyone was scared of because they knew that there was a line they couldn't cross with her. And so she played that role really, really well. So I feel like in some ways that kept her from becoming the joke that Booster and Beetle became, because she was the one who everyone took seriously. And I like that aspect about her. And again, yeah, obviously in Dr. Jennifer Schwartz-Levine and I talked at great length about how they overdid it sometimes, but for the most part, she's a fantastic character in the Justice League Europe comics. I love it. And by the way, All-Star Comics number 58, I pulled mine out of a quarter bin, just letting you know.
Oh, nice work, bro. Well, that's good. And also with the respect with the cat, when they show her interacting with the cat, or like the thing I mentioned at the beginning of the episode where, you know, she kind of looked at Rex with the whole idea that he might want to put it down. It's an interesting contrast. You know, she's angry all the time, or she's stern all the time, but then she's got this cat that nobody likes that she likes. And I think Giffen showed that, like, you know, there's this other side to Power Girl. You know, I thought that was cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And the cat in some ways is a bit of an orphan like her. You know, the cat's on his own too, and she adopted him. So you've got two people on their own who connect, and they work together, and yet they both push everyone else away. So in a lot of ways, they're very much very similar.
Absolutely, man. So thanks for letting me talk about her again. And I'm stoked that DC's actually bringing her back in the current stuff. Unfortunately, it's forcing me to buy current issues again. But you know what? Good for them, right? They need all the buyers of comics they can get.
I don't buy a lot of new comics, but I am more than happy to shell over my money for Justice Society and the Stargirl stuff that's going on right now. Happy to do it. So
yeah, me too.
All right. So now we need to move on to the toughest decision of the issue. This is where we are going to nominate the
One Punch Award.
This is where we are going to pick our favorite moment from the issue, whether it's fantastic or shocking or dramatic or funny, awe-inspiring, whatever, whatever it might be. Both myself and John are going to pick one moment, and that's going to be awarded the coveted One Punch Award. So, John, you're the guest, which has been fairly unfortunate for me for about an hour now, but what is your selection for your One Punch nomination?
I could have gone with the obvious, which was the actual punch on page, what is this, 20.
Oh, the brutal ones. Oh.
That's just obvious, but it is a good, if there's any, aside from Guy Gardner getting his clock cleaned by Batman that you've named this after, this is a pretty good one, but that's not, I still have to go back to something I mentioned earlier, and I hate when guests do that, when they summarize it and then they repeat themselves. Well, I'm going to do the same thing.
That's fine.
is that scene with Dimitri? Tree's wife and the kids and the plate of Starro's, man. It's just, I mean, it's kind of disturbing. And I thought it was just really poignant. You know, it's his own wife, you know? And anyway, I thought that was a cool scene, man.
Interesting. We both picked ones that have emotional triggers. Mine wasn't that scene, but I can see why you picked it. Mine was a few pages later, the one on page 10, we're on the rooftop, and our heroes had to watch that one poor guy get chased down and get, you know, one regular Londoner get chased down by other Starro Limeys and get the starfish on his face. Because both of them, though, carry sadness, and both of them have Dimitri as the center point. So it's interesting. Dimitri's really the center point here. So the decision now is we have to decide, is yours more meaningful with the family and the creepy plate of flying starfish, or this one poor guy? Make your case, sir.
Well, I mean, I'm looking at it again right now, your page, and you referenced it earlier, this might be the only sort of, I guess you'd call this an architecture, a section.
A cutaway, render, maybe? Yeah.
Yeah, where they show Dimitri's head inside the helmet, looking through the slit, and then they use the panels are the slit shape, right? And that one panel,
gosh, I didn't even notice that.
It's funny, huh? The panel where the Starro is being placed on the Londoner's face, and you can see the one eye of the guy about to get, he's like, he knows it's coming or something, and it's a very good rendering of, like, fear, you know? You're the host, man. This is a really great page. It's a really good scene. But I think they're both equally good. So, you know, you're the boss, man. But I think these are both, yeah, I think good pickup. We both pick things where there's a fear emotion going on.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So I'll make one more case for mine. It's got surprint on it. I just realized. The bullseye's all done with surprint. But tell you what.
Is that a good thing?
Yes, it is. Okay, we're going to call it a draw. They're both about Dimitri. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to award it to Dimitri.
Okay.
And it works for both. So congratulations, Dimitri. You have won the One Punch Award. Please wear it with pride. It is tangible for our love for both of these moments.
Woohoo!
All right. So, John, I got to ask you a question, or ask a favor, really.
Oh, okay.
Would you mind hanging around here at the London Embassy for a while? I'm a little worried about it being overrun by a bunch of Starro-controlled Mary Poppins.
Oh, yeah. No problem, man. I'll just go. I'm going to find Power Girl, man. I mean, Wally told me she's recharging her batteries by sunbathing nude on the roof. He also told me that she beat him senseless the last time he snuck up there, but I'm sure she'll embrace her number one fan leering at her from behind the chimney, right?
Yeah, I'm sure that's going to really end well for you. I hope you have a good dentist.
Well, you know what? It's probably going to be worth it, though.
All right, John. Well, good luck with that. But don't worry, we will bring you back at the end of the show. And folks, while John is getting pummeled to death, I'm going to read your listener feedback in a segment called
Justice Log.
Man, it has been nice to get back to some regular issue coverage. It's been a lot of fun. But how about those interviews with J.M. DeMatteis and Bart Sears? Those guys were amazing. Now, some of you folks have teased me about doing so many Meanwhile episodes just to keep this show alive indefinitely. I promise you that is not the case. It's just been some fun ideas and some amazing opportunities to speak with some celebrity creators. Now, I did the math recently on what I'm expecting left to cover in this show, and I'm projecting we've got about 19 more episodes. Now, that might change if we get further amazing opportunities to speak with other celebrities. So what that means, though, is that this show should wrap up around the middle of the year 2024. Now, after the JLI show is done, if you want to continue to follow my podcasting efforts, I'll be ramping up my production on episodes of the Justice Society Presents podcast and the Once Upon a Geek podcast. So please feel free to check out those shows now. I would love to have you guys over there because I got to tell you, like, as I'm moving towards the end of the JLI podcast, one of the things I'm going to miss the most is the feedback section. I love communicating with y'all. I love our conversations. I love your contributions. And I'd really love to carry some of the energy from this show over to the Justice Society Presents podcast and the Once Upon a Geek podcast. All right, so as I get into your feedback for this time, I do apologize in advance if I miss anyone. I'm covering the feedback from multiple shows across multiple months, so we're talking dozens of social media posts to track down. Also, Twitter has been acting a little difficult lately, as some of you may know, so getting information from there hasn't been as easy as previous episodes. So again, if I miss you, please just let me know in the comments, and I'll make it up to you next episode. All right, so get out on the social medias, tag us at JLI Podcast, let us know. We want to hear your thoughts because, you know, I always say it's about building a community of online JLI fans around the show. Now, remember, when you're posting comments on our website, if you're outside the United States, let me know and we will assign you the appropriate embassy. Now, as I get into your comments from these three episodes, I'm going to be pulling from our website, email, social media, all that kind of stuff. And I'm just going to be sharing bits and pieces because there's so much feedback, especially across three episodes. I'd never get through it in a reasonable amount of time. So we're going to be covering the most recent episodes featuring Justice League Quarterly number 3 with my guest Steve Gibbons, my interview with J.M. DeMatteis, and my interview with Bart Sears. First up is a general comment from Walter Cahill. Walter says, I gotta say, I've always been a Marvel guy. Sure, I knew about Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, all the rest, but I just never got into DC at all. But one day recently, I discovered Justice League number 4 at my local comic shop. And I remembered having seen this book back in the day, so I bought it and loved it. About the same time, I discovered the JLI Bwahaha podcast, and I'm really enjoying it. And then soon after, I was hooked. And now I'm on a mission to collect the JLI, JLE, and everything, the Justice League from that time. Thanks, Shag. I love the podcast. Aw, well, thank you so much, Walter. I appreciate that feedback, and welcome to the embassy. All right, so let's get into it. Justice League Quarterly number 3. First up is Doug Adamson from our Scottish embassy. Doug says, what did strike me about the review of the issue was that this story was one of the few times that the JLE and the JLA actually crossed over and mixed up the teams for a proper adventure. It was great to hear about Beetle and Fire and Ice and Guy interacting with Cap and Power Girl and Flash and Silver Sorceress. Normally, these crossovers seem to not be adventures so much as major battles. So in this case, it is world-shattering outcomes, but since that already happened in the past, this didn't seem to be as big a stakes as those. I got the impression that this felt more like the old JLA-JSA crossovers, which is something I always felt the JLA and JLE didn't quite manage as well. Then Doug says, I always felt there should have been more crossovers between the two books, even if it was just one team member showing up in the other book for part of a story or just to hang out in the rec room. Then he says, I also like the lineup of the group that eventually got shrunk down because that's actually an excellent team, which would have been a solid book in and of itself. Fair point, Doug. It was a pretty cool group of heroes. Then we hear from Rob McCarthy. He does the Hell on Wheels webcomic. Rob says, a way too serious take on this issue. Wouldn't Green Lanterns have serious rules about time travel? Wasn't Cronus time travel the cause of all evil? yes, Rob, you make some good points about time travel and the Lanterns. Then we're from Matt Ev from our Scottish embassy, also goes by Ultron is my Elvis. Matt says, this absolutely ridiculous Honey, I Shrunk Marty McFly take on is a joy from start to finish. But it does indeed have some surprising amount of heart. And I love this early period of McCone's artwork, as rough it is in places. He undoubtedly improved over the years, but I think the quote-unquote better he got, the less it appealed to me. There's something about his line, his sense of motion, that really is just captivating. And as an aside, I have a degree in philosophy, just saying, and I once described the plot of this issue during a tutorial on time travel, causality, and the grandfather paradox. My fellow students were super impressed and absolutely blown away by my citation of such an authoritative and insightful source. Or either that, or they looked at me strangely in mortifying, mildly disgusted silence, and we never spoke of it again. My memory's a little hazy on this. Thank you so much, Matt. I appreciate it. Then we hear from Denim Jedi, who, you may recall, Denim Jedi's been binging the entire JLI podcast, almost all 7 years worth in just a few short months. Denim Jedi says, I finally caught up and I'm now commenting here on the website. Says, I really enjoy this issue. And Denim Jedi suggests we should also continue the Publix grocery store talk. I may or may not have been an employee of the place. Oh my gosh, Denim Jedi, another Publix-related person? This is crazy. Well, it is a pleasure to have you here. And for those of you that know Publix's slogan, that was, yes, a bad joke. All right, we have Gus Casals up next from our Argentina embassy. He does the Alfred Pennyworth Presents podcast and his Legion 60 Years Later's podcast. Gus says, yes, this cover is definitely by Mike McCone. And for one, I'm glad you addressed some of the issues with this art. I do not like Mike McCone, and the JLI office kept using him over and over. You know, Gus, Mike's artwork gets mentioned quite a few times in the comments. For example, up next is Mike Dynas from our Pacific Canadian Embassy. He says, I am just not a fan of McCone's art. That Splash Team shot page has some serious problems with Power Girl's legs, and Silver Sorceress looks warped. Having said that, I can admit that he's gotten better than the previous issues, and the splash page of the Justifiers is pretty nice, and like you both mentioned, I feel he really shines with random technology, and Liberty the Dog looks amazing. But I'll say it again, why does Blue Beetle have marbles in his mouth on the cover? You know, Mike, now that you've said that, I can't unsee it. Mike also says, you guys took the words or feelings right out of my mouth. It was more of a somber issue than the regular series, but well done. To see the reactions of the regular JLI members to seeing the original JLA members hits me in all the feels. Yeah, Mike, me too. Absolutely. Up next is Tim Price from the Outcasters, Batman and the Outsiders podcast, and the Batgirl and Huntress podcast. Tim says, now a big moment in this issue is General Glory, Silver Sorceress, and Blue Jay all in the same room. The Marvel analog characters all together. Yeah, so folks, we're talking about the Captain America analog, the Scarlet Witch analog, and the Yellow Jacket analog all together here. So Tim says, the Marvel analog characters all together in the same room and nothing. No sly remarks, no strange looks, no gags. Honestly, I didn't think there would be, but on this read, I was so hoping I was wrong. Oh, but the Justifiers were the highlight of the issue, and the parody was brutal. And I've been buying Avengers comics since 1980, yes, all the way to the present. Giving them the Assemblers the full-on JLI treatment was hilarious. Oh, wait, what's their team name again? Justifiers in this issue, but I'm sure I remember them being called the Assemblers earlier. Yep, Justice League Europe number 19 on page 2, Mitch and Sorceress refer to the team as the Assemblers. Ah, wow, great catch, Tim. And, you know, honestly, I would expect nothing less from our resident Justice League historian. All right, up next is Liz Ann Oswald. She has her own YouTube channel. Liz says, about the bit with the robot, meaning Mitch's robot when he's driving essentially a robot of himself. Liz says, I am shocked that Shag saw this and did not make a Doctor Who reference, since a mech like this with a miniaturized heroes was used in the episode called Let's Kill Hitler, and to greater effect in the episode called The Marriage of River Song. You know, Liz, you make a great point, and I should have picked up on that. Liz goes on to say, it's kind of sad that Mitch ends up causing the very catastrophe he went back in time to stop. Though I guess it is kind of poetic. Yeah, I mean, there is something sort of sad and tragic, but sort of, as you said, poetic, Liz, about what happened with Mitch. All right, up next is Paul Hicks from our Australian embassy. He does shows such as Waiting for Doom, the DC OCD podcast, and many more. Paul says, Shag, Mark Millar is pronounced Mark Miller, but I did enjoy your brazen certainty as you told everyone something completely and utterly wrong. Don't ever change, you beautiful idiot. Aw, well, thank you, Paul. That's so sweet of you to say. And now, based on your guidance, I appreciate, I will evermore refer to him as Mark Millar. Perfect. Thank you, Paul. Then we're from Jason Lady, the author of the young adult humorous fantasy novels Monster Problems, Super Problems, and now Time Problems. Jason says, I liked the JLA-GLE team-up in this issue, and that Captain Atom got to be the leader, and that Ice was included. She got left out of a lot of these stories. And I actually thought that Mitch's wacky robot's funky walking was pretty funny. Given the overall 1970s vibe of Angor, I thought maybe he was supposed to be mistaken for doing some sort of disco superfly strut. No, Jason, I think you're dead on. I think that's absolutely what they were going for, given that they traveled back in time 10 years. I think that was absolutely the vibe they were going for. So you were picking up what they were laying down. All right, up next is Martin Gray from our Scottish embassy. He does the Too Dangerous for Girl blog. Martin says, I do remember this issue well, and it's great that you both enjoyed it. As with other book-length tales, it would have benefited by being cut by a third. But as it was noted, what a treat to see the members mingle. And the last bit of a spotlight for Silver Sorceress and the Brilliant Blue Jay, he of the sexy receding hairline. Oh, Martin, you do you, buddy. And then he says, and if yes, Mike McCone is still the Tyro talent, but he was developing fast. And of course, this is Shag. This sent me on a Google search for the British slang definition of Tyro. So thanks for that, Martin. All right, up next is Simple Pending from our UK embassy. Simple Pending does the Power Girl blog, of course. They write, as that film about that Wangina knockoff shows. Oh my gosh, that's hysterical. Okay, so clearly we're talking about Wangina and the Thor movies. Okay, all right, so here we go. I'm sorry. Simple Pending says, as that film about that Wangina knockoff shows, it's hard to mix tragedy with comedy. But I think this issue just about pulls it off. I do kind of want more in-depth character study about the three Angor survivors dealing with survivor guilt, but it's a little unfair to judge a comic on what it's not. No, Simple Penny, it would be interesting to see more of the pathos and the guilt that the Angor survivors are dealing with. But then the flip side is, you know, how deep do you go when the characters are just a parody? You know, it's tough. Now, I mean, Marvel did really deep dives with Squadron Supreme, so it is doable. But it does make you, you know, just think about what could and couldn't be done. All right, up next is Michael Atchison. Says, what a great issue and a great episode. Is it just me, or is one of the panels towards the end of the book where Mike McCone is using John Travolta as a model for Wally West under that mask? Mike then shared the page with me. And I gotta say, Mike, it does look like Wally is staying alive. All right, it's time to move on to our interview with JMD Mateus, all about the Demultiverse and the JLI. So I heard from Captain Entropy, says, that was awesome, Shag and JMD Mateus. Thank you. Well, on behalf of both of us, you're welcome, Captain. Then we heard from Tim Price, who goes, seconded, I can't really think of anything just to add, but just a joy to listen to. Well, thanks, Tim. Then Liz Ann Oswald chimes in again, says, it was pretty cool that you're able to sit down for interviews with the creators. And it's interesting to hear their thought process on creating comics. Absolutely, Liz, it's fascinating to hear, especially JMD Mateus. He brings so much thought to the discussion. Then Liz went on and speculated on what her favorites might be from the upcoming Demultiverse. And Siskoid and Martin Gray did the same thing, did some speculation, so that's fun. Then Martin Gray says, it's so great to hear JMD Mateus. He is such a generous spirit. You know, Martin, that may be the best descriptor I've heard for JMD Mateus, because he really, truly is. Then from Steve Cronin, he says, great episode. Really enjoyed hearing from JMD Mateus and what he's working on now. Thanks for rushing this out. So I was able to order my autograph collection today. First time using Kickstarter. Pledging was a good experience, and always cool for us to support artists and their new work, not just the classics. Yeah, great point, Steve. Thank you. Then from Doug Adamson again, he goes, thank you for the interview. It was great to hear from JMD so soon after the last time he was on the show, which was, what, over 5 years ago? Oh, yeah, compressed time for me in catching up. Yeah, you may recall, Doug is one of our folks who's been binging almost 7 years of the JLI podcast in just a few short months. So, yeah, he got to hear JMD Mateus pretty recently, at least from his perspective. Heard from Adam Ackerman from our Denmark embassy, who says when he was a substitute teacher, middle school was his favorite to sub. Look at that. All right. Then we heard from Jose Rivera, who's the author of The Underground Adventures. He says, great episode and a great guy. I got to meet him 10 years ago when he was kind enough to sign my Justice League Armageddon 2001 annual, and I gave him a copy of my book. One of my all-time favorite New York Comic Con memories. Talk about a great down-to-earth guy. Yeah, he really, really is. All right, up next, and we're going to get into the Bart Sears interview discussion all about Justice League Europe. Oh, he was fantastic. First comment is going to come from Gus Casals. He says, superb episode. What a great chat with Bart. Also, I got a real thrill of living vicariously or by proxy with our listener input. Big smile. He says, I have two big takeaways from this. First is the credit that Bart gives to Giffen's layouts for improving his storytelling. The other is his take on fantasy physique for fantasy characters. It's a great insight and allows me to understand and appreciate even more of his art. Finally, great question about Eclipso, and I did notice at the time his art style changed. Never would have figured it was intended as a simplification. Ah, thank you so much, Gus. Then heard from Rob McCarthy, who says, I've always been more of a Marvel guy, but DC has Marvel beat on company-wide crossovers, as I bought every Eclipso crossover and every Zero Hour crossover, whereas the Secret Wars 2 is the only Marvel crossover I bought all of. And I still think Eclipso is the only one of either company's events that has had a built-in reason for all the heroes to be there. Interesting observation, Rob. And yeah, the Eclipso crossover is so much fun. Heard from Bucky749, aka the American Samurai, who has his own YouTube channel. Bucky says, Shag sounded so excited about the interview, like a kid in a comic store in the 1970s that just got $20 from his grandma as a birthday present. And thank you to you grandparents everywhere. That's fantastic, Bucky, and I agree. Thank you to all you grandparents out there. Unfortunately, some of us JLI fans are at the age where we're becoming grandparents ourselves. All right, then Doug Adamson chimed in again. He goes, I was delighted we got to hear about the COP Cops toy range. Comic and cartoon that I only remember seeing on vacation in Florida. Perhaps some of the other UK residents of these boards will recall Cops on our toy shelves, but I don't think I saw them. I actually have a few issues of Cops somewhere, and it was interesting that it led to his work on Spectre and then Invasion. I recall the change of artist from McFarlane to Sears on Invasion, and at the time I hadn't figured out what had happened or why, but I recall preferring Sears' work more. Then he says, Mr. Sears was great, and if there's any actual art on the video, please let me know, and I'll give it a watch. Otherwise, I don't want to risk having to look at Shag's man cave with envy for too long. Doug, just to let you know, and you folks at home, the only real difference between the video version and the audio version is the audio version has a little bit more at the beginning, where I took time to thank everyone who contributed questions to the interview. Because, YouTube is a little bit of a different animal. I didn't want to put a long introduction in there. I want to get straight to the interview because, YouTubers have less of an attention span than you refined folks who listen to podcasts. So, all right, up next is Martin Gray. He says, congratulations on one of the best artist interviews I've heard, Shag. What a lovely guest Bart was. Martin, you're right. He was lovely. And he says, the anecdote about Pablo Marcos's kids inking part of the background was hilarious. And how great to hear that George Tuska and Vince Coletta, a taken-for-granted penciler and a scorned inker, made some of his favorite pages ever in Iron Man. I've always been fond of Tuska, and no one did a better job on Jack Kirby's Thor than Coletta. I also enjoyed hearing how Bart realized Ross Andrew was a subconscious influence. Yeah, it was so interesting listening to him. Tim Price says, this was such a great listen. Excellent job, Shag. Now, I keep thinking, in another timeline, what if Bart Sears got the gig drawing Spider-Man rather than Todd McFarlane? And how would that have changed not just Bart and Todd's career, but the creation of Image Comics? Craziness. But it could have happened. Picture Spidey with Bart's muscles and Mary Jane with Bart's attributes. Whoa. Tim, that makes for an interesting what if. Then from Liz Ann Oswald, who says, was awesome to hear Mr. Sears' interview. Was cool to hear about his years and his work and going to the Kubert School. I was shocked to hear that he left to work at a furniture store before submitting his first published work. Glad to hear he chose to submit the work, though, because since a lot of comics wouldn't be the same without him. Specifically, Justice League Europe and Exo Man of War. You're right, Liz. And I heard from Tom Erb, says, such a killer interview with one of the best guys artists ever. Jim Gillespie says, wait a minute, an unpublished biker chick story for Larry Hama? Sears drew the Savage Sisters? I remember that story being announced, but then the magazine Savage Tales was canceled before it was published. Damn, I need to see that. I have no idea if it's out there, Jim. Let us know if it is. Then heard from DC Dave, who goes, wonderful episode, Shag. What a great interview. You did a fantastic job, and Bart was a great guest. Love listening to speak about his experiences. Thanks, Dave. Yeah, it's all down to Bart. He was amazing. Then Mike Dina says, I'm guessing that Bart's time at Hasbro honed his design chops so that when he finally quit to work on comics, any costume designs he made were pretty solid. While I know we have fun ragging you about Power Girl's yellow and white costume, I can admit that the design is pretty solid. I just didn't like the change. No, I think you're right, Mike. I think a lot of the toy design probably did contribute to the amazing character designs he came up with. They were from Rob Kelly from the Firewater Podcast Network. Now, if you don't know, Rob is my podcasting life partner. And he does shows such as Superman for All Mankind podcast, Treasury Cast, and so many more, including some shows he and I do together. Rob says, Bart mentioned one of his friends, Mark McNabb, who helped hook him up with Wizard Magazine. Well, I worked for Mark McNabb from 1994 to 1997 in his studio. One of the most fun experiences I've ever had. And then, 25 plus years later, Mark McNabb was at my wedding. So this is shag for a second. This is sort of wild that between the time I interviewed Bart Sears and now, I've actually been in the same room as Mark McNabb. So at Rob's wedding. So small world. All right, back into Rob's comments. He says, regarding Bart's time at the Joe Kubert School, he's being modest. All those guys worshipped him. Part of it was his art style, which was very bold and macho superhero action, but it's also because he was working on a current book on the shelves, which really seemed magical to all of us trying to break into the business. It was one thing to hear about how things were in the 1960s or 1970s. It was another thing to hear from a guy who was working on a book that you could see for yourself every month. That's a great observation, Rob. Thank you so much. And Rob actually helped me with some of the Joe Kubert School questions. So thanks, Rob. Then final comment goes to Jose Rivera, who really, folks, we have him to thank for getting the ball rolling on that Bart Sears interview. He connected me and Bart. So thank you so much, Jose, for helping make it happen. Jose makes some comments about the Eclipso series. He says, I adored that crossover because a lot of the comics I was given when I was a kid were the annuals with Eclipso. Then when I got back into comics as a teenager, I tried to get as many of those annuals as I could. And yes, the gem on the cover was awesome. Yes, it was, Jose. And then we just, I want to say thanks to a few people who left some nice comments. Rob Sventek, JT the Exterminator, John Schaefer Hames, Hoover Jeremiah, James Williams, Damian Lee, Brad Metz, and Bill Beer. All right, folks, this is the part of the show where I thank everyone who shared the show on their social media timeline. We're talking Facebook and Twitter, and yes, it is a long list of names. We have established that over the 7 years of this show. However, these folks have showed their support and promoted the podcast. So it's important to me that we recognize each one of these individuals, and our community is growing. This time out, we've got nearly 100 names. Now, remember, if I missed you folks due to some of the weird shenanigans over Twitter, I apologize. Just let me know, and I will correct that next time. So here is everyone who helped promote the last couple episodes by sharing on Facebook or retweeting our Twitter. Our thanks to three guys I've never heard of, JMD Mateus, Bart Sears, and Adam Hughes. I don't know. They must be just some comic nerds. Then thanks to 808 Comic Book Fan, Adam Ackerman, Al Girding, Andre TFG, Between the Pages Blog, Blue Beetle and Booster Gold Facebook Group, Brian Siufu, Captain Freakout Psychedelic Radio, Changing Shades, Chris Franklin, Chris Lewis, Chris Lydon, Christoph RDGZ, Christopher Luke, Coffee and Comics, Comic Book Addicts, Curator at Retro All the Time, Damian Droe Whiter, Dave Steele, Dave's Comics Heroes Blog, David Ace Gutierrez, Days of High Adventure Podcast, Digest Cast, Doug Adamson, Dr. Ange, Dr. Jennifer Swartz Levine, Dr. Pop Culture Bowling Green State University, Ed Moore, Than Films Fridays Podcast, Frederico Hernandez, For All Mankind Super Friends Podcast, Geek to Me Radio, Gus Casals, Homework the Podcast, Into the Weird, Jake Muir, Jared Albrecht, The Yard Sale Artist, Jeff Poliere, Jeffrey Brown, Jeremiah Daw, Joe Tonello, John Coos, Jose Miguel Miron Martinez Riena, Jose Rivera, Justice Treklog, Justin Steiner, Keechee Baker, Con L, Like a Rolling Spock, Liz Ann Oswald, Man Firestorm, Mark's Mess Podcast, Martin Gray, Martin Kogan, Matthew Cody, Matty Jets, Max Romero, Maz at Mazinger 1978, Michael Kramer, Michael Thomas, Mick Jameson, Mike Dinas, Miracle Man, aka Old Man Komodo, Mo Walker, Mountain Comics, Patrick's Tactics and Tutorials, Paul Kean, Pragmatic Golem, Prairie Justice, the Greg Saunders Vigilante Podcast, Randy Micah Smith, Relatively Geeky Podcast, Richard Dent, Rolled Spine Podcast, Scott X, Secret Wars and Beyond Podcast, Siskoid, Spellbound Comics, Spy Dart Jerusalem, Steve Givens, Superman Radio Revisited Podcast, Symbol Pending, The Pat at Pat Stuff NS, The Scary Stuff Podcast, The Innocent Sinful, Tim Price, Tomb of Ideas, Tom A. Scorsese, Treasury Comics, Trent Lewis, Turbo Comics, Tyler Ford, Warlock Thanos Podcast, Wibbly Wobbly Dicey Wicey RPG Podcast, Willie Yarbrough, Yojimbo at DC Animated Universe Resource, and Zek Cap Boots. Woof. My thanks to all of you for your support of the JLI podcast. Folks, your feedback is such a critical part of this show, and the community of JLI fans we're building together is fantastic. I'm not kidding. Seriously, like, doing the feedback is one of my absolute favorite things, because just interacting with all of you and being part of this together and being fans together and sharing our love and banter and everything, it just, I love it. I love it. I love it. So thank you, everyone who's contributed to the JLI podcast feedback over the years. And again, if I missed anyone, I'm terribly sorry. It is probably the fault of Steve Gibbons. Let me know, and I'll be sure sure to include you in the next episode. So keep those cards and letters coming, folks. Go to our website, which is firewaterpodcast.com/JLI. That is where most of the comments are going, so that's the best place to be. Over on Facebook, also, you can catch us at facebook.com/JLI podcast or Justice League International, Blahaha Podcast. And on Twitter, we're JLI Podcast, and our email is JLIpodcast@gmail.com. My thanks again to JMD Mateus, Bart Sears, and Steve Givens for appearing in the most recent episodes of the show. And thanks to you listeners again for such a wonderful, wonderful collection of feedback. Now, we're going to take a quick podcast promo break. And when we come back, we'll see if we can bring our guests from this episode, Jonathan Riddle and John Koos, together in the same episode. Dr. Fate.
Dr. Midnight.
Starman.
Johnny Quick.
Wildcat.
Power Girl.
The All-Star Squadron. The
Firebrand.
Amazing Man.
Huntress.
Cyclone.
Sandman.
Mr. Terrific.
Stargirl. Commander Steel.
Our Seven Man. Soldiers of
Liberty.
Infinity Incorporated.
Those are just some of the celebrated and beloved heroes associated with Earth 2 and the Justice Society of America.
These daring mystery men and women banded together in 1940 to form the first super team in comics.
They inspired a decades-long legacy of heroes who would follow in their footsteps. And now they've inspired us to launch a new podcast.
Justice Society Presents, a new anthology on the Fire & Water Podcast Network featuring a variety of theme shows with different hosts celebrating some of their favorite comics and characters associated with the Golden Age of Comics, Earth 2, the JSA, and beyond.
Join the fight for justice and subscribe to Justice Society Presents on the Fire & Water Podcast Network.
Imagine a podcast that celebrates the things we love. Why spend time being so angry and cynical about our fandoms? Join me, the Irredeemable Shag, for a show where we're just trying to be happy. The Once Upon a Geek Podcast. Our discussions focus on a variety of geeky subjects that we're passionate about. While the topics will be ever-changing, our focus will be on science fiction, comic books, what it means to be a geek in this world, and other nostalgia-fueled ideas. Life is short. Focus on the positive. Find your joy. The Once Upon a Geek Podcast, part of the Fire & Water Podcast Network. All right, folks, we are back from break. And yes, it does appear the JLI teleporter has brought both together both Jonathan and John together for us. Now, first, Jonathan, thank you so much for keeping an eye on Elrond and Booster Gold. I hope all went well with the switch out on the bet that they made. And thank you so much for being on the episode. It's been a genuine blast.
You know, I was going to take that $20 from Elrond, but then he offered me this most adorable Okaran tea set. Pre-invasion vintage. You can't find those in stores anymore.
That's a heck of a bargain.
I'd be a fool to pass that up.
Right. I can't imagine where Elrond learned these bartering skills. Oh, my gosh. Well, again, Jonathan, this has been so much fun. I'm so glad you appeared on the show. Why don't you tell the listeners where they might be able to find more of you?
All right. So for the most part, I'm kind of living in the dark. I don't have much of a web presence right now, but if folks would like to get a hold of me, we can use email. I'm at jriddle.illustration@gmail.com. And if you're in the Columbus, Ohio comics scene, look me up. I'm around.
Awesome. Well, thank you again, Jonathan. It's been an absolute joy. And thank you to Wendy for letting me borrow you for this time.
Thanks, Shag. I've had a great time hanging out in the embassy. And did you know there's a cappuccino machine in the kitchen?
The last thing this team needs is caffeine.
Amen.
John Koos. Oh my gosh. Power Girl fan to the stars. Thank you so much for being here on the show. This has been an absolute blast, man. I really appreciate you being on the show. Why don't you tell the people where they can find you on the internets?
Sure, man. You can find me on Twitter at John Koos. I mean, I was an early adopter, even though I didn't start really using the thing until your podcast, to be honest with you. I try to sign up for things early just to, you know, have my name so I'm not like John Koos 22 or something like that.
Right,
you know?
Right.
But I have a podcast. It's hard. It's hard to keep up because, you know, it's schedules and, you know, whatever, running out of material. But my friend that I grew up with, literally six houses down from me during the pandemic, we decided to do a podcast about growing up in Southern California, Orange County in the 80s, where we just talk about what it was like to be a teenager in that time, you know, kind of this suburban paradise. Like he worked at Disneyland and I worked at Knott's Berry Farm and blah, blah, blah. So, but it's hard. It's super hard. There's probably like 30 episodes, but I think anybody from our age, we talk about, you know, television shows and movies and things like that. But, you know, it's just fun. It's something to do, but it's damn hard to keep these things going.
And, I can't imagine what you might mean by that.
Yeah, I know. And I guess, you know, in closing, man, it's been a real pleasure stumbling onto the JLI podcast, and I wouldn't have met so many like comic minded people on Twitter if I didn't start following you, and then it just spiraled from there. And you and Rob doing a great job. And even if you talk about Alpha Flight, you guys are awesome.
Well, thank you so much, and everyone from Canada thanks you for the crack as well. Well, John, honestly, I've had a lot of fun chatting with you. It's been, you know, we're comic fans of a certain age, and we have a lot of parallels in our background, and it's been a real joy. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Keep up the good work, bro.
All right, folks. Well, that is going to do it. Now, come back next episode when we cover Justice League America number 52 and Justice League Europe number 28. And we'll have two more guest hosts to help me cover the issues. Who will they be? Come on, people. You know how this works. You're going to have to wait and find out next episode. Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, I'm Shag.
And I'm Jonathan.
And I'm John.
And you've been listening to the JLI Podcast.
Want to make something of it?